Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
And The Lyric Stage, presenting The Drowsy Chaperone. This bubbly love letter to musical theater includes mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. Now through May 12th at Lyric Stage Boston. Tickets at lyricstage.com.
I'm Jim Bradley, ahead on Boston Public Radio. The U.S. is inching closer and closer to defaulting on its debt, with talks between the White House and the GOP stalling yet again. We'll get thoughts on that, the hashtag disaster on Twitter, and other D.C. headlines from Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne.
I'm Marjorie Egan, talking about failure to launch. The Twitter announcement about his 2023 presidential bid went about as poorly as it could for Ron DeSantis. Could the race for the GOP primary be over at the start? And are you reveling in the chaos alongside Truth Social troll former President Donald Trump? We'll take your calls. And stick around when we'll talk to King of Comedy, Pose, and American Horror Stories, Sandra Bernhardt, about her one-woman show coming to Boston next week. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GPH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We're going to be live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. Governor Healey will join us to take our questions and yours from 1 to 2. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Marjorie. Before we introduce our friend in a couple of seconds during the conversation, to read the story in the Globe today about the coyote that chased the woman and the dog. Do you know who the woman was?
I do now.
Sue O'Connell. And her dog, Maud, are the chasees. Sue's going to be – she's fine, by the way. Sue's going to be with us tomorrow. I don't know if the dog will be there, but coyote jumps over fence to chase woman and her dog in Boston about Sue O'Connell.
We're joined now. Maven. It's lucky she's still with us, Jim, by the sound of things.
It is. We're joined on Zoom by Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne. E.J. is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is 100% Democracy, The Case for Universal Voting. E.J., it's great to see you.
It is so great to see you. I want to hear what that dog has to say tomorrow. And
exactly.
May I comment on the day's, one of the day's most important events? I will just say the word Celtics in seven, but we can go on from there.
By the way, for those who know, he's a Fall River kid like my colleague here,
we're
Marjorie
hoping.
Egan.
We are
very engaged in our whole family. I spent my birthday this year at game four. Down in Atlanta.
Gosh.
It was my gift, and all our kids came. So it was one of my favorite birthdays ever.
Great. And a good night to be a courtside.
It was a great night to be in Atlanta. Yeah.
So let's start with a bad night for Ron DeSantis last night. We'll play a little of the difficulties with the technical glitches in the DeSantis opening salvo as a presidential candidate. Here it is.
Steve, do you have a comment or question? I think you just need to unmute. If Steve can unmute, then we'll go ahead and ask him for a question. If not, we'll keep rolling here. All right. Three, two, going.
I'm there.
All right. Sorry, Steve.
I'm there, guys.
Oh, there
you
go. All right.
I would never come out of the house again. Let me just say that right there.
Now, you know, love him or hate him, Donald Trump came down the golden escalator. He's got his gorgeous wife, Melania, right in front of him in the gorgeous dress. All these people just drooling at the sight of their favorite guy, Donald Trump. And then you have this debacle. So what are the political ramifications, E.J. Dionne?
I just want to tell you something funny. I had some notes on the rollout, and the last note was going, gone. From that moment, that is a soundbite that we are going to hear over and over and over again. I was sort of thinking puckishly, well, you know, politicians try to lower expectations. And so Ron DeSantis is doing one heck of a job. I think what's really striking is not just that this was a disaster and not just that it was not a good night for Elon Musk either.
No.
Sort of betraying some of the problems over at Twitter. But it actually feeds what is basically a 5-month narrative for DeSantis, where he started the year after a big victory in his reelection in Florida, leading Trump in some of the polls, looking like a strong candidate. And almost everything that's happened from January to now has been downhill for DeSantis. He's now down in polls, you know, a whole bunch of polls by 2-1 or more to Donald Trump. When you ask Republicans whom they're for, he's shedding donors, or he has shed some donors. And so now this was the moment when he was going to put a stake in the ground and say, I'm reversing it right now and really taking control of this race. And now he's going to have to spend, you know, another week kind of living this down. There was, you know, there's almost no one who viewed this as anything but a disaster. They tried to spin it. There were so many people there that, you know, it burned up Twitter. But it wasn't even that many people, 700,000 people. There are more people, you know, who follow other people on Twitter. So it was a really bad night for DeSantis. And the last thing is, there is an odd overlap between the Trump spin, which is this is a disaster for DeSantis, but also a lot of liberals who deeply mistrust DeSantis, who cannot resist pointing out how consistent this is with his whole trajectory.
Well, you know, let me just add a couple of things. I don't know if your intimation was when you said, you know, I have to live with this for another week. I don't buy another week. I think because it exists on tape, it's going to be with. We're still seeing pictures of a politician I admire greatly, Mike Dukakis, in a damn tank. I mean, you know, and it's what, 35 years later. And it also, beyond everything you said, EJ, I think the slogan was almost, he didn't literally say this, Trumpism with competence. I mean, that is sort of the unspoken message. You can't even get a damn announcement off with the richest, most, you know, whatever man in the world. I think this has much more staying power than it, especially since it was the kickoff. What's the old line in politics? The best day in every candidate's life is the day he or she announces his candidacy. Not for this guy. No?
No, I don't disagree that this has a long shelf life. That's why I was struck by that soundbite, going, gone.
Yeah, you're right.
I think
you're right.
That's gonna roll forward. But all I was saying is that, you know, the announcement is supposed to kick you off, make you stronger. And he's going to spend the week simply trying to live that down and trying to get to another place. But I agree, this is something, and Trump sure as heck won't let it go.
I should say so.
And Trump is not sort of wild about Twitter anyway, and he's surely not going to be happy with Elon Musk. So he'll be happy to trash Twitter too, you know?
You know what else I wonder about this? I wonder about the competence of his entire team, because when you think of presidential announcements, it's more just like what Trump did, or there's some people in front of a crowd and everybody's enthusiastic and it's very
detail attended
produced.
To, right.
And you just wonder, especially since not that many older Americans are even on Twitter. I think it's something I was looking up this morning. I think it's like 7% of people over 50, you know, big voters are not even there. It's that middle of the pack of the country. And even there, it's not huge. So
you don't even get to see him, even if it worked
exactly.
Well.
Exactly.
No, that was what
audio.
Really struck me. If you go on there, you just see the sort of little line, which makes you think of a heartbeat of a campaign, maybe. But it was just.
No, I was looking at it for 15 minutes in the car last night, waiting
too.
For this thing
me
to
too.
Start.
Exactly.
But, yeah. So what? Why do they even go this route? I don't get it.
Well, I think, you know, it's maybe the paradox of being in a hole, which they then dug deeper, which is I think they were trying to sort of talk about a new approach to campaigning, you know, somehow to make, you know, DeSantis be the Republican of the future. I don't know what they were thinking, because I totally, Jim's point is right that, you know, really good campaign announcements can last out there. If you go back, you know, on the upside, Joe Biden's video, you know, which sort of
Charlottesville
mm-hmm. and talking about the, you know, the soul of the country and restoring it, that became their sort of go-to moment right through the administration. Yeah. People still in the administration still like to refer you back to that. That doesn't solve all its problems, his problems, but it is sort of a, you know, significant that a good announcement can have a long half-life too.
We're talking,
and as you mentioned, the Trump moment at that escalator, which know, is frightening to some of us, but is something we still remember.
You know, you mentioned a minute ago, E.J., Dion, that when DeSantis first started talking about running, or at least people were talking about him running, you know, a couple of months ago, he was actually leading Trump in a few polls. He's now on CNN this morning behind 2-1. And some people think his numbers grew in part because he was, I mean, I can't even believe I'm saying this, because he was indicted in Manhattan. It appears from all the reporting about Jack Smith, the special counsel, Fannie Willis saying clear calendars in early August, suggesting there are going to be indictments of a lot of people, maybe including Trump, there, that I'm looking for the person in America who says, oh, I was a big Trump fan, but now that he's been indicted for insurrection and messing with documents at Mar-a-Lago, I'm no longer with him. He is immune from almost all this, and what would defeat most of us makes him stronger in so many ways, doesn't it?
Well, he told us that when he said he could shoot a guy on Fifth Avenue. So let me, I've been sort of pondering this question a lot, as a lot of people have. And, you know, I'm trying to go against the grain on that, because everything you say sure seems true. And Lord knows he's going to raise a ton of money for some perhaps phony defense fund after every indictment. Every indictment is also a good fundraising tool for this guy.
Incredible, yeah.
I'm just wondering if going down the line, say, to the fall, there are Republicans out there who say, yeah, we think this is unfair, et cetera, but will we really be able to beat Biden with this guy? And there's a very smart Republican pollster I talk to a lot called Whit Ayers, who has an interesting sort of division of the Republican Party, where only about 10% of them are never Trumpers. Wow. About 30% of them are always Trumpers. No matter what he does, he's got that 30, it's immovable. He describes the middle 60% as maybe Trumpers. Wow. Those are people who voted for Trump a couple of times, might be inclined to vote for him again, but are inclined maybe to think about, should we really do this again, or will that lose us the election and some Senate and House seats as it did in 2022? DeSantis wanted to be the candidate of that middle group. You don't attack Trump too much because some of those folks still, a lot of those folks still kind of like Trump, but you can displace him. The flaw in that theory, and it's, you know, not, this is not which theory, I'm just describing the flaw in the theory that says those maybe Trumpers could shift, is that you need somebody to go to, and DeSantis, who is supposed to be that guy, doesn't look like that guy now. Is there anybody else in this field who could draw those
people? Is there?
You know, there is a lot of buzz around Senator Scott right now, but and I think he has some possibility of sort of showing well in Iowa, where being on the ground, being a kind of hands-on politician who likes people, unlike it appears Ron DeSantis, can actually make some progress. It's just hard to see right now who that candidate is. But I still think there are Republicans out there scratching their heads and saying, yeah, we may love this guy, but will we throw the election away? And somehow DeSantis has to turn that around. But he's not showing us that he's, that he's the guy who can turn things around.
You know, I loved your column, E.J. Dion, about Biden is reclaiming the word freedom for Democrats, because it seems the only kind of freedom that the Republicans are talking about is the freedoms to buy as many AR-15s as you want to. And they're talking about taking away freedoms of parents to make medical decisions of their children, schools to choose what kind of books they're going to have in the classroom, obviously abortion. I think this is a great move. So tell us what you said.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think, by the way, just to shout out a colleague who had a recent column on this, Jamel Bowie of the New York Times, whom I really admire a lot, and talked about Roosevelt's four freedoms, which I had mentioned in my column, and, you know, the Republicans' four freedoms, which include the freedom to coerce, which is
exactly
a very interesting play on words, but absolutely true. Democrats and Pete Buttigieg, let's shout him out, made, part of his 2020 campaign was based on the idea Democrats have to grab that word freedom back. And you do go back to Roosevelt. And you do look at the four freedoms where you're linking freedoms that protect people from government, but also using government to give people more freedom in their lives, the freedom to go to college, the freedom to improve yourself, the freedom to be able to retire without having to work six jobs at the age of 70, you know, stuff like that. Those are freedoms, too. And I think the Republicans have really put themselves on the wrong side of an awful lot of very middle of the road people, especially but not exclusively women, suburban voters, not only on the issue of abortion with the Dobbs decision, but also on this schools, you know, books in schools and libraries. There are a lot of parents in the country who do not want extremists picking the books that go in their library, which is essentially what you are allowing to happen if you're letting a small group of parents censor books and say these have to come out of the libraries. Yeah, we can have a good debate on what a curriculum should look like and all of that. But I think there are an awful lot of middle of the road parents who just do not want, they want the schools, their schools to teach kids stuff. And the irony is that DeSantis and other Republicans complain about indoctrination by liberals.
Yes.
If anything that smacks of indoctrination, it's saying, no, we're not going to let kids read these books.
We're talking to E.J. Dion. E.J., you wrote about disparaging what it is that Republicans led by McCarthy are looking to cut to make a debt ceiling deal and what they're not interested in cutting. I want to get to that in a second. Before I do, are you, I don't know if you're a betting person or not, but I operate in the assumption this is all performance art and they already know essentially what the deal is. And we're going to hear it at midnight on May 31st or some such thing. Am I unduly optimistic?
You know, I was where you were, and I think that may still be right, until last night, yesterday, and this morning, where what you're starting to see is a lot of unease among Democrats.
Democrats, yes.
The Post, my paper, had a very good story on how unhappy Democrats are. I want to quote Jim McGovern, good Massachusetts congressman, who said Democrats are not going to vote for a bill that screws poor people while protecting rich people. End of story. And I think there's an interesting fillip here where the assumption going in was McCarthy could get about 150 Republicans to vote for this thing. Democrats would produce 70 votes just to get us over the line. But that presumed a deal that was not so awful from the Democrats' point of view that 70 Democrats could vote for it. Now you may be looking at a deal, you know, the vibes you get right now are this deal is going to be more favorable to Republicans, steeper cuts, you know, work requirements that are phony. You know, they don't get anybody a job, but they tie working people up in red tape to get government benefits. And you might lose a lot more Democrats and need more Republicans. So, yeah, I'm still inclined to think, Jim, your assumption is right that they'll get there. But I am not as confident today as I was 2 days ago, because I think there's some real rumbling out there.
You just mentioned, EJ, that the story about how the Democrats want Biden to get up there and give a speech, get up and say something about this, fight for this thing, make it clear to people what's at stake here, instead of just kind of lollygagging along. I mean, that was a sense I got. I think Hakeem Jeffries said something along those lines, that he's not fighting for this.
Right. And I think what's important about what you just said is you said Hakeem Jeffries. This is not just the most progressive wing of the Democratic Party right now. Hakeem Jeffries, a very mainstream Democrat. And, you know, the White House is saying we thought we had a good division of labor. Biden made his statement in Hiroshima. Not a great statement, but it was a really tough speech against the Republicans. And then he's been silent. And the White House thinks, well, we got a division of labor. House Dems will, you know, and other Dems will trash the Republicans and will be the responsible negotiators. But I think there's more and more doubt about whether that works because McCarthy and his allies are out there every day.
Exactly.
Catching Biden saying that, you know, we need more cuts, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think pressure is building on Biden to say something definitive about what's going on. But I, as I say, I think there's something changing right now. It may go back to where it was, but there's a kind of unease out there, particularly among Democrats.
Yeah, I understand the unease. And by the way, I share it. There's no greater admirer of Jim McGovern than me, and because he actually walks the walk, literally and figuratively, when he walks across the state around hunger issues. However, to quote a pretty well-known Democrat, election have consequences, as Barack Obama once said. And so McCarthy forces Biden to do things that we decent people find to be horrible, like the things you write about, like the work SNAP requirements benefits and all that sort of thing. These Democrats are going to vote because they don't like the deal that was cut to default on the debt ceiling? I don't think so. I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't be saying what they're saying to try to force the discussion into fairer territory. But at the end of the day, don't you think they're going to do the responsible thing, which is, as painful as it is, to target low-income people with the pain of the cuts? What's more painful to more people is a default.
So first, let me do my obligatory Fall River Marjorie Egan shout-out. Jim McGovern used to represent part of Fall River.
That is correct. Right. That
before
is correct.
They changed the lines. No, I think you're right. And that the Biden people are arguing, and there's something to this, that, look, we were going to have to negotiate a budget we didn't much like down the road, because with the Republicans controlling the House, we couldn't get a budget that looked like the budget we would want. So what we're going to do is negotiate all this now, get it out of the way, extend the debt ceiling beyond the election, and then have normal government again. That's sort of the happy story, even though you and I and Marjorie won't like the cuts. The question is, can they contain the cuts? In other words, I think part of the issue here is this a bad deal from the point of view of progressives or even anybody who cares about poor people like Jim? Or is it a really, really bad deal? What does that look like? And that's where using the debt ceiling is really troublesome. McHenry, the Representative McHenry, the Republican negotiator, who's more reasonable than some of their people, was asked, well, what are you giving the Democrats? And he said, we're giving them the debt ceiling. Well, wait a minute. The debt ceiling is not supposed to be something that is a partisan thing. It was raised when Trump was president. None of you guys said anything much about that. And so I think you're getting to the stage where the Republicans seem to be pushing way harder than Biden might have expected. Now, maybe, again, we'll discover it's not as bad at the end of the day. But I think that, you know, everything the Republicans are saying is signaling they want a really tough deal. Maybe that's for their base. Maybe they'll make a better, you know, a more moderate deal. But it's just feeling like the tilt is toward them right now.
You know, EJ Dion, we don't have much time, but you were in Nancy Pelosi's office the other day, and the thing, it was a really interesting column, and people should read it, but and you can describe it if you choose. What I'm really interested in, though, is people who've had great power who have the power removed, either by choice, not running for re-election as speaker. I can't imagine Nancy Pelosi not a speaker. And I'm not saying that Hakeem Jeffries doesn't seek her guidance or Catherine Clark doesn't or whoever. How is Nancy Pelosi accommodating herself to a post-speakership life, if you know what I mean?
I got to say, I had the strong sense, and I'm not alone in this, I think, that she is really happy. I think that she feels that, you know, she's a historic figure. She did amazing things. She's, you know, more than anyone, I think, is responsible for passing the Affordable Care
Act. I think so. Obama says that, doesn't he?
Yeah. And, you know, which is a huge achievement. But there's a whole lot of other stuff that she got done. And I think that she can look back at what she did with real satisfaction and that she left on sort of, from her point of view, good terms. The Democrats lost the election, which meant she couldn't be speaker again, but they didn't lose it by very much. They did way better in 2022 than anyone predicted. So they weren't, and she wasn't routed in that election. And I think this is an opportunity for her to really You know, it's a memo to historians, period, from Nancy Pelosi, where she can sort of talk to people, put stuff on the record, get all kinds of praise from all kinds of people. And you know what? At a moment when we're talking about, you know, it does there come a moment when politicians should step down and they don't?
Exactly. Yes, I think
chose,
so.
she looked at the circumstance and said, this is time for me to go. And she arranged her succession because the three leaders That's there absolutely right. are all people Pelosi wanted. So I get a sense that she is very happy with where she sits. And I don't think that's some show she's putting on. I think that is really where she's at.
You know, I meant to mention this when we were talking about book bans. That one of the ones that really knocked my socks off was Amanda Gorman, her inaugural poem that she read. And, you know, kudos all around the country. And some, I think it was a single woman in Florida that complained about this Amanda Gorman poem, and they've put it on abeyance until they get to the bottom of whatever radical things Amanda Gorman was saying that need to be eradicated from the curriculum down there in Florida.
Crazy. Hey, before you go, because we're running out of time, are you one of the foolish former Fall Riverites who thinks the Celtics are going to do what the Red Sox did in 2004 or no?
Yes.
Not you, Marjorie. The other Fall Riverite.
The Bible teaches us to have faith in things unseen.
Oh, that's right.
And so, you know, 0-149, which is...
No, 150. 150 after the Lakers.
That's what the Lakers
added
the
number
right.
the other day, right.
Yes, thank you. The 0 after 150. Jason Furman, who's an economist up at Harvard, who used to work for Obama and for Clinton, sent out a great tweet, which he sent me, where he said that Boston fans are like economists predicting inflation. One win, and they decide they are the 2004 Red Sox. And I just wrote it back and said, that was awesome, and I am one of those people.
You're an honest man, EJ Dionne. It's great to see you.
EJ,
thanks so much.
Thank you very much. We're all keeping our fingers crossed here.
Take care.
Great to talk to you. We've been speaking with Washington Post columnist EJ Dionne. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. His latest book is 100% Democracy, The Case for Universal Voting. Okay, up next, we're going to keep this conversation about the Ron DeSantis debacle going. Did you tune in breathlessly to Twitter last night?
I tried.
And you're sitting there wondering what the heck is going on? Was this a very good idea? Is his candidacy over, or is this just a blip that will be ridiculed, but he can move on to ban further things and be mean to other people all across the country? We're talking about last night's kind of botched Twitter announcement of the candidacy of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Regan live at the library tomorrow with Governor Healy. And by the way, we just heard that promo. We actually like to think on this show we do talk to people who matter and talk to a broad spectrum of people, and we hope you think so too. Last night was a hashtag disaster, as they say on Twitter, for two of America's most likable people, Elon Musk and Ron DeSantis. The whole thing got off to a rip-roaring start.
I'd like to welcome Governor DeSantis for this historic. We're just trying to get it going because it's so many people. That's unfortunate. I'd like to never seen this before.
You know, let me tell you something before I continue for a second. Is SNL on vacation or for the summer? Is this like fodder for?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a writer's strike.
I mean,
forgot.
I guess they couldn't have done it any better.
Well, it
just shows an incredible hubris on Elon Musk's part,
And a lack of preparation on the part of the competent alternative to Donald Trump. In any case, if you didn't attempt to listen, Marjorie and I are both in our own cars.
Sitting in the car,
about to
in
go
the
to
rain.
A GBH event, yep. Waiting and waiting. It went on and on with glitches and problems. For about 20 minutes, we did give up, delaying his actual announcement. It almost made us nostalgic for what Marjorie mentioned before, and EJ did, that golden escalator moment. For his part, over on the somehow still functioning Truth Social, Trump had the, quote, truth to share about Ron DeSantis. Here's what he said. He desperately needs a personality transplant, and to the best of my knowledge, they are not medically available yet. A disloyal person. What he means by that is everybody agrees that had Trump not endorsed them the first time, in all likelihood, it wouldn't have been governor to begin with. Our number is 877-301-8970. As you know, that's for texting or calling. We have a few questions. Could this technical glitch announcement have happened to two more deserving people? Can Ron DeSantis recover from this? We began that discussion with E.J. Dion. Have you ever had a disaster in your personal life that is comparable? And did you recover? 877-301-8970. By the way, let me be clear here, and I know myself well enough to know I'm not being delusional.
Yes.
This is not because I'm not a fan of the cruelty of Ron DeSantis. I think that stays with you forever. As you know, as EJ hinted a minute ago, talk about the opposite extreme. We are still seeing, 7 years later, Donald Trump coming down the damn escalator.
Right.
Wherever he came down the escalator, 7 years later. As I said, unfortunately, we see this, still see the picture of Dukakis in the tank. This kind of stuff stays, particularly when we just played this sound. It is such ridicule.
The only saving grace of this for Ron DeSantis is that you couldn't see him. So we'll just have to hear it. You know, you don't have the visual because it was just audio, which is another thing that was so weird. I mean, as I said to EJ Dion, you have to question not only Ron DeSantis' competence, but the
competence of his team. I agree.
They thought this was a good idea. I mean, wouldn't you have practiced this like a million times and made sure that you weren't going to be overloaded with people and that it was going to be able to...
By the way, if people don't know the impact of this, mm-hmm. EJ said that he had heard there were 700,000 people. I read 600,000 people, but this is beyond dispute. After they finally recovered 20 minutes in, the number of people watching or listening, was down to 300,000 people, which surely did not achieve any of the goals that Ron DeSantis had.
It did not. And the other thing, as I said before, too, people always worry about older voters because older voters are most reliable.
They are.
And something like 7% of people over 50 in the United States of America are on Twitter. So I think you're maybe eliminating a lot of your audience. You might have been better off going with a good old-fashioned television announcement. So I love some of these headlines. This is from Fox News, and Fox News has decided it's going to go after Trump. I don't know who it's going after.
Well, it's
at the
going
moment.
After Trump, and it seems to be in DeSantis' side until last night.
Until last night, where the headline was, much-hyped Ron DeSantis presidential announcement, a disaster on Twitter. They went on to call it amateur hour. And then there was another one from Fox saying, programming alert. Want to actually see and hear Ron DeSantis? Tune into Fox News at 8 p.m., where he's going to be interviewed by the former Congressman Trey Gowdy.
Did you see the thing where the New York Times described it as the conference call from hell? Which, and this is the New York Times.
And here's something else. I forget where this is from, but this is DeSantis campaign fails to launch in a Twitter meltdown.
877-301-8970.
Turn into all these anti-DeSantis ads. And as I said, it couldn't happen to two nicer guys, really, than Ron DeSantis and Elon Musk.
Is there a piece of you, by the way, Elon, we're going to get to your calls and texts in a second, but is there a piece of you that says, I know this is probably preposterous, because Musk said, I mentioned on the air maybe a month or 2 months ago, that he was leaning towards endorsing DeSantis. When you are this wealthy and have this big an operation, I assume you attempt to be prepared for most things. Is it possible that a Musk set him up? Do you think that's even remotely possible that Musk had a change of heart? He's no longer a DeSantis guy, despite
what we
thought.
It does make you wonder, but several people are texting in about how his plane, rocket, you know, went down in flames not that long ago. So maybe there's just a competence level. And, you know, how's your Tesla La running, Jim? Is it running okay?
It's going very well. Thanks for reminding people. Appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Before we get to the calls, I was trying to think. I've had many disasters, professional disasters in my life. Many. I'm trying to think, and maybe I've forgotten. Feel free to embarrass me if you can think of one. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever had anything quite this humiliating.
Well, you know, I know that you are a Cambridge City Councilor, Jim.
I was a radio talk show host.
But I don't think you've reached the magnitude of celebrity that Ron DeSantis has.
Oh, actually.
So that the fall from grace.
I wasn't talking about a comparable thing. I'm saying comparable in your own life. You know what I realized? Remember when I did that show on NECN and they forgot to erase the tape when I redid it. And I said the F word like nine times.
The F word, that's right.
In the first 2 minutes. So that was pretty bad, by the way.
That was pretty bad.
877. Yeah. But you know what the good news was? Nobody watched the show, so we didn't have to worry about it. 877-301. That's the beauty of low ratings on cable TV.
When you're Ron DeSantis talking about how you are the competent guy, that you get everything right,
exactly,
you've got it locked
exactly.
up and down pat, and you get the personality of the bottom of a shoe, which he does. He is a whiny. I mean, already people are talking about how it disliked you. Remember when Ted Cruz, where we talked about how much they hated him in law school, they hated him in college, they probably hated him in grammar school.
What's the great Lindsey Graham line? One of the greatest lines ever. If Ted Cruz
were beaten to death or shot in the floor of the Senate, they couldn't get a single senator to, you know, to stand up and testify against the killer. So it wasn't shot or beat up. It was something like that, though. They hate him. So I don't think he's not as bad as Ted Cruz. But I mean, come on. This guy is just a boring whiner.
By the way, before we go ahead, Sue O'Connell, who we now call Coyote Woman, as you'll hear tomorrow or today if you read the Boston Globe, says, remind Jim about his live hit. Yeah, I was, unfortunately, on live NBC when I walked off the set at NECN when the police had the younger Tsarnaev covered, and I said into a live mic that I forgot to turn off when the web person said, what do we know? I said, we don't know S about anything. And it went out, and Brian Williams was hosting at that moment. That was
pretty embarrassing. Well, I have a lot of mistakes, but I'm not going to go into them and embarrass myself once again. Richard from Framingham, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, Jim. Just to give you one little pat on the back, I called you about 15 months ago.
Yeah.
And I was completely wrong about Ukraine, and you were right. But that's another matter.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Go ahead.
When you're watching the network battle of the sociopaths, it's hard not to be happy when any one of them steps on a rake.
That's a good one, Richard.
A great day in America.
Beautifully put, Richard. It's very patriotic of you, Richard. Thank you. And thank you for the historical correction.
Yeah, I love people that say that they were
It's usually we who made the mistake, but we try to own up to it whenever we do. Yeah.
Yeah, we make a lot of mistakes. I make a lot of mistakes.
Well, we make a lot of mistakes. 877-30. What do you call it? The battle of the psychopaths?
The battle of sociopaths.
Sociopaths.
Maybe psychopaths as well. I'm not sure. Steve from Norwood says, Florida, where presidential candidates go to die. Just ask Jeb Bush.
Well, that's another good point, by the way.
Steve in the car. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Florida goes to die. Florida is red now. There's no more question about who they'll vote for the presidency.
That's true.
You know?
Whoa. You mean in the final.
Florida.
You don't mean in the primary, because Trump could win the primary in Florida. You mean in a final, it's going to be not Joe Biden getting the electoral votes. You're right about that, it appears. Yeah.
That's correct. Right. And you're cackling about the plight of DeSantis. Yeah. That's expected. You know, no matter what he did. Right. But I'll tell you this. It's 2024 is a long way away, and DeSantis could be a zero. People go from zero to hero and hero to zero in a week. All right. So DeSantis, a lot of people like what he's doing, especially his fight against wokeism. Now, that may not seem good for you, but a lot of people do not like it. And so I think he's got a following.
Yeah, but yeah, Steve, can I say I agree with you that a lot of people like what he's doing. I do not. You're correct about that too. But if you're listening to EJ a few minutes ago, when you've dropped precipitously in the numbers, it is critical historically, and maybe this will be different. It's critical historically that you explode out of the box, and with the excitement of your announcement, you pick up a lot of steam overnight. If he can do that and recover from this in the short term, I agree with you. He can be formidable down the line. I'm not sure he makes it. I don't mean he's going to pull out. I'm not sure he's not being ridiculed in a week or two to the point where he can ever even get his message out. Is that not a legitimate analysis?
Yeah, it is. But what I don't want you guys to forget how many great candidates we have in the primary. Nikki Haley would be a superwoman in the Democratic Party. Person of color?
Well, no, she wouldn't, Steve, because she's anti-choice. She's against abortion.
And the Democratic Party is overwhelmingly pro-choice. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Who's your person you think is the most acceptable and the most likely to beat Joe Biden, Steve, for you?
I think Scott.
Tim Scott.
But yeah, I like Haley.
Well, let me say the thing about Tim Scott that EJ said a minute ago, and I find this very appealing too.
He's upbeat.
Even if you don't like his politics, he's not angry at people. He doesn't disparage people, and particularly in contrast to DeSantis and Trump,
I don't think any of these Republicans can win nationwide, because 1 in 4 women in America has had an abortion.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people to criminalize and say are horrible people that should be going to jail. Yeah. You have more and more stories about women with wanted pregnancies who are going through hell because they have a dead fetus and they can't get anything to do
anything. Okay, so Steve, thank you for your call as always. I agree with you. So when I say to you in response,
people underestimate this all the time.
You said the same thing about Donald Trump. Your response would be the Dobbs decision had not happened then, so it's a different landscape.
Well, I think people
thought. Is that what you'd say?
I think when he was running for a candidate, people thought he was full of baloney, even when he said he was going to appoint pro-life judges.
And that Roe would never be repealed.
That Roe would never be repealed.
Yeah, you're
and that
right
Donald
that.
Trump
you're
spent,
right.
spent 75 years of his life being pro-choice, and then he decided he was anti-abortion when he was running for office to get the votes of the evangelicals. But he's not anti-abortion. Now, I don't know what Ron DeSantis really is, but I think people underestimate how much that's going to hurt Republicans.
Well,
including
based on
Scott.
Recent elections, that you may be right.
They
you
just
may...
passed a 6-week abortion ban in South Carolina. That's where Haley's from, and that's where Scott's from.
That's a very good point. Roger in Marblehead. Hi.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to ask both of you if you had heard through your various media channels if there was any truth to the rumor that there was a giant death ray that emanated from the top of Space Mountain at Disney World. That was known to cause communication errors across several wavelengths.
We're not at liberty to disclose what our sources have told us, Roger, but you can say whatever
you'd
like.
That's a good one.
Well,
I've heard several unsubstantiated rumors, and I really have to believe that.
Well, you're welcome to spread substantiated rumors here anytime, Roger. Thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
President Biden sent out a tweet saying, "This link works."
I know, that's pretty good. That's actually a pretty good
if people wanted to donate to him. So we're talking about the debacle of DeSantis' performance last night, asking you think if it matters. Is it going to hurt his campaign going forward? More of your calls and texts. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Regan and Jim Browdy. We're live at the library tomorrow, and almost as important as Governor Healey joining us from 1 to 2 is that the woman who was chased by a coyote, which we learned about today in the Boston Globe, which jumped a fence to go chase that woman and her dog, that would be Sue O'Connell, will be with us tomorrow as well. If you're just joining us now, we're taking your calls and texts at 877-301-8970 about the DeSantis debacle last night. What'd you make of it? Is it survivable? And have you had a thing that's comparable in your own world? And have you survived it? 877-301-8970.
You know, Michael from Lynn has an interesting theory. He thinks Twitter employees were the cause of the issue with his dear friend,
Ron. That's a brilliant
idea,
because they're also angry at Elon Musk.
I would do as little as possible to help this campaign launch if I work for Twitter. I didn't think of that.
That is brilliant.
That's a very good one. Let's go to Steve in Newton. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Long-time listener. I think it's the first time I disagree with Jim.
Okay.
I don't think this is going to stick with DeSantis. What I think will endure is his alignment with Elon Musk. He's like a walking, talking time bomb. And he chose to align himself early in his campaign, brand himself with a billionaire. And this guy, every other day, tweets out something that's disparaging, borderline bigoted. And I think this is really going to stick with DeSantis, and it'll help the Democrats.
He's got to win a primary in which I think the number I read this morning, 70% of the self-identified Republicans think Donald Trump is a legitimate president of the United States. Don't you think Muskism may not appeal to you, me, or Marjorie, but it probably has pretty significant appeal to the people DeSantis wants to corral, don't you think, Steve?
Yeah, no, I think yes, billionaire to billionaire. I think there is an alignment there. Wealthy, that's who I'm going to be. I like these guys. But I think if this pushes into a battle between Trump and DeSantis, which it looks like it's going to be, Elon kind of opposes Trump. He kind of went against Trump, pushed against Trump, pushed against Fox. And I think that this is going to stick with DeSantis a little bit in the primary, but definitely if he becomes the primary choice.
Got it. Steve, well, thanks for the call.
I mean, to be serious for a minute, my guess, and this is only a guess, that if Trump's indictments become too overwhelming, if there's too much between now and the election, if you have Mar-a-Lago, if you have Georgia, if you have the January 6th thing, all these things, and the hush money, all these things, it could be that it gets to be overwhelming and that Ron DeSantis could slip in. But otherwise, I think it's going to be Trump, don't you?
Well, if Trump falls because of these indictments that are likely to come, I don't think this is coming from a guy whose political projections are wrong almost universally. So let me say that up front. That would be me. I think it then becomes DeSantis and somebody else, you know, and I don't know who the somebody else is. Again, despite the policy differences, I find Scott to be somebody who could be appealing. Well, yeah, that matters when you're running against two people who essentially are talking about death and destruction, who don't appear to like anybody. I mean, I think that really, really matters.
But one of our texters reminded us that Huckabee was very upbeat when he ran for the GOP nomination, didn't get very far.
But Huckabee was not running against two people who were like doing Darth Vader imitations. No, I'm serious. It makes a big difference. He was running against other human beings.
I think the thing with DeSantis is he just seems to revel in the cruelty. He really loves it.
Well, not only that,
he thought that was swell when he set all those poor migrants. And you see these people on TV coming
into Martha's Vineyard thing?
Yes, thought it was a riot. You see people coming in these trains, the beast they call it, riding on top of a train, risking their lives with their children, no food, no water, blistering from the sun. Like, this is a big joke. Oh, let's send them all to Martha's Vineyard. He seemed to think that was just funny.
Well, you know, beyond the cruelty, which I think he has in common with Trump, Trump's ability to connect to people is immense, obviously. And I don't know if you ever listened to the what ultimately aired. I did really early this morning after they got the glitches out of the way. The whole point, I assume, of doing one of the major points of doing this thing on Twitter and having it with Musk and whoever the other guy was, is to try to have it conversational, to make him more human.
Right.
It was like he was giving a speech. I mean, if you hear DeSantis, and I assume most of you didn't stick around to listen or didn't attempt to listen this morning, maybe you did, it didn't achieve the goal of humanizing a stiff candidate. It was a stiff candidate in a stiff conversation. Yeah. He just doesn't have that. Having said that, let me say one more thing. Counter to myself, he won his most recent election by 19 points.
He did.
A landslide. So if he is as horrible a candidate,
Charlie Crist.
If he is as unappealing as Marjorie and I describe him to be, there are a ton of people in the third biggest state in the country who thought we're dead wrong. So we might be dead wrong. Jordan in the car. Hi.
Hey guys, how are you?
We're good, thank you.
Well, I just wanted to respond to the Republican gentleman that called in and
Steve,
said Billy is his pick. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm from South Carolina, live in Massachusetts now, and a huge Democrat, very liberal, would never move back to South Carolina for that reason. But having lived in South Carolina for part of Haley's term, I would also endorse her as a Democrat, because she's so ineffective, she would be the least scary candidate of all of the candidates on the Republican side. I mean, DeSantis is terrifying. Trump is terrifying. Scott is one pick away from Clarence Thomas. But Haley really did not accomplish a single thing while she was in South Carolina. She'll take credit for all of the business that she brought to South Carolina. The only business that came in was the BMW factory in Greenville. And she had very little to do with that.
Mm.
So I love her for a Republican candidate. I'm on board with Steve.
I'm sure she'll be happy to hear that. Hey, Jordan, thank you kindly for your call. We're glad you're here. 877-301-8970. You know, I said this one. I think we're talking to EJ. Maybe I said it to you off the air. I can't remember. If this had happened to you in our world, and you don't have to say again, we're not in that stratosphere. But I know, the world in which we live, if we had an embarrassment like that, would you even come to work today?
Jim, my career has been a pockmark of embarrassments. One endless.
No, but what? Nothing.
Oh, come
like,
on
the biggest day in your journalistic life, is the biggest day in his political life. In the biggest day in your journalistic life, whatever that was, mm-hmm. you'd had a moment even remotely as horrible and as humiliating as this. And you know, by the way, the line that is so embarrassing. We should have said this before. The explanation. I think he said this on Fox News. He said it somewhere. We broke the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't break the internet with 300,000 people watching the thing.
I may be the only talk host in America that had to go to how to talk on the radio school for 6 months.
She did. But there's nothing wrong with that. As you were earnest.
And you know what's really depressing?
What's that?
It really hasn't worked, has it?
Yeah, it's worked beautifully. Ellen, you have a minute. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. One of the things, Marjorie, when you say that one in four women in the
right.
United States has had an abortion.
Right.
I also want you to add one in four men have also made the choice to have an abortion.
Great
so
point.
So women do not make this technically on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I thought was comical is the Republicans are always screaming about experts. You know, you can't trust them. You can't trust them. Donald Trump had a production team from Hollywood.
Right.
Choreographing that entire thing. He also had all the major networks who have the most expertise in cameras and videography. Just because Elon Musk made billions of dollars at one thing doesn't make him perfect at everything. We constantly do this. We think because somebody's rich and somebody got rich doing one thing, they must know how to do everything.
Yeah,
Ellen,
that was a,
good
that
one,
was
a Ellen. Great
call. That was a great call.
That was a
You're
great
right.
call.
Across the board.
Thank you so much. Glad we could fit Ellen in before the hour was over. Okay, thank you. We didn't get to everybody's texts and calls, but anyway, we try. Coming up, the former sheriff of Suffolk County, Andrew Cabral, joins us. Do not go away. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy, ahead on Boston Public Radio. In a major public address, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts said earlier this week that he and his colleagues were continuing steps to address questions about ethical standards on the nation's highest court. Guess we'll just have to take him at his word. We'll see if former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrea Cabral does. Then it's legendary actor, performer, comedian Sandra Bernhardt, appearing before her one-woman show, Spring Affair, that lands at the City Winery in Boston.
Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young joins us to take a look at Mayor Wu's sometimes frosty relationship with the city's business sector, and if that reputation is accurate. Travel guru Rick Steves, fresh off a birthday tour through Spain. He's back just in time for his upcoming show with Keith Lockhart and the Boston Pops. Then we'll open the lines to get your memories and hear some music of the late, great Tina Turner. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hi, I am Marjorie Yeagan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. I want to remind people that we're going to be live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. We're going to have some great music. Plus, Governor Maura Healey will join us from 1 to 2 to take our questions and yours. That's at the Boston Public Library. Hello again, Jim.
You know, I don't like to criticize you on air, but I feel I have the need to.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
So you're supposed to tease the best of what we have tomorrow. I agree, having Governor Healey is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Having that musical group is really good.
Mm-hmm.
But having the woman who is featured in the Boston Globe today as the person who was chased by a coyote who jumped over a damn fence and chased her and her dog, and we're going to have her live on the air. That'd be Media Maven Sue O'Connell. You should be ashamed of yourself not
Escape.
To promote that.
That's right. We are so grateful that our Media Maven Sue O'Connell is still with us to report on her harrowing.
By the way,
running.
Can I just say, I don't want to
They're
waste
out of hand.
I read the head of the story, and you know when you read the head when you're busy, you say, well, we're not going to do that on today's show.
Yeah.
But I start it, which is a way that I know that I want to read it when I have more time. time in the afternoon.
Just save it, yeah.
And I didn't know until Jamie told me. Do you know who the chasee is? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So she'll be with us tomorrow. Oh, no, also the governor, but she'll be with us
She will
tomorrow.
Be with us for the whole, to detail the whole terror ordeal.
We're joined now on Zoom by Andrew Cabral. Andrew's the former sheriff. I'm not kidding, by the way. I'm the former sheriff of Suffolk County and the former secretary of public safety in the Commonwealth. Andrew, are you not with me on that? Is that our biggest attraction tomorrow or what?
Totally is. And the funny, one of the funniest parts of that story was, and it was sort of, you know, you kind of, you could blink and miss it. It said that she usually carries a walking stick to fend off turkeys. And it's like, where are you walking on that you're subject to coyote attacks, turkey attacks? I was laughing.
Oh, God. She's fine, by the way. We wouldn't be making light of this.
Plus, she's not walking around this little 12-pound Pekingese or something. She's got a good-sized dog,
Maud,
I mean, these coyotes, they're going rogue. They're going after big dogs. They're going after human beings. I tell you, we better all get baseball bats to take the dog for a walk. But anyway, Andrew Cabral, I want to play a little sound. Chief Justice Roberts, he was speaking at the American Law Institute, and this is what he had to say about the ethical problems at the Supreme Court.
I want to assure people that I am committed to making certain that we as a court adhere to the highest standards of conduct. We are continuing to look at things we can do to give practical effect to that commitment, and I am confident there are ways to do that are consistent with our status as an independent branch of government under the Constitution's separation of powers.
Okay, Andrea, what did you think of that?
Well, my response to that was, how dare you? All of the years that you have been a judge at various federal levels and now the Chief Justice and have presided over that court for quite a while now as Chief Justice, how dare you talk prospectively about what you think, you know, you're hopeful you can do to have the 9 top judges in the United States of America adhere to basic ethical standards that lawyers and other judges operating in the lower courts all across this country are held to account to adhere to every single day. How dare you say that at an awards dinner where you're getting an award, no less? I mean, it's gobsmacking to me that he is content to preside over an historically bad court, not just in terms of its decisions, in terms of how its personnel ascended to the bench, and in terms of its ethical conflicts. It's a trifecta.
Well, you know, it seems to me the only reason he even, and I use the term advisedly, addressed the ethical issues is because he was forced to, because at least a significant chunk of the public is concerned about. I'm not naive enough to say a majority of Americans are losing sleep at night because Clarence Thomas is a grifter or whatever it is, but a significant chunk of people are. There was a wonderful piece in the New York Times by Stephen Vladek who said, Supreme Court justices don't like being criticized in public, which is a good reason to keep doing it. And he cites what he considers to be evidence to say they do respond to public pressure when it's strong. Now, of course, the argument's going to be 2/3 of the country is pro-choice and they still did Dobbs. But there are examples of what he's talking about. Are there not, Andrew Cabral?
No, and I think, you know, the fact that you are a separate and co-equal branch of government and probably have a much greater or it is desired that you have a much greater level of independence to your work than perhaps folks in the other two branches does not mean that they don't respond to public pressure. And I think it's absolutely correct that historically we've seen changes in what SCOTUS has done based on public pressure. So I think that keeping that up is great. Anyone who has a position of great power, especially in a democracy, has to be held to account in some way or another. And public pressure is a good way to do that with the SCOTUS because they are separate and co-equal. But one of the things that you know, bothered me about, you know, Roberts, his remarks are generally arrogant. He considers one of the worst things he ever had to do was erect fences around the SCOTUS. But taking away for the first time in the history of the SCOTUS a right that has been exercised and enjoyed for over 50 years, that apparently caused him very little consternation. And he mentioned that his mentor was a judge from the appellate court, who was revered, apparently, from what I've read about him, Henry Jacob Friendly, Roberts clerked for him. A lot of notable lawyers and judges have clerked for him. But Friendly's career is marked by a lot of things that made him so sort of notable and unique. But one of those was his absolute respect for and insistence on following precedent.
Yeah.
He also had opinions about judges trying to enact social policy without having a sense of how that would affect people. And so he's written, Friendly's written, a, for people who are interested, Friendly's written, obviously, had written a lot as a judge. He's, you know, I believe he's deceased at this point, but his writings reflect issues that he had generally, even with Brown versus Board of Education and with Roe versus Wade, about enacting social policy or being driven to that. But it wasn't that he disagreed with the idea that women should have safe access to abortion. It was because he felt you have to take in all of the information from the court. Courts have to be very careful. They making really broad, sweeping changes without having a sense before the court of how those changes will play out is an issue. So we had process issues with it. But for him to say this is his mentor and this is a person he cares about, when this court has completely, you know, sort of basically, you know, thumbed its nose at its own precedent and has made social policy, is also just infuriating.
Well, one of the things about Roberts, too, I mean, he's not in Clarence Thomas leagues, who's taken these kind of get gifts from billionaires that have business before the court thing to a new level. There's something creepy to me.
The wife is headhunter.
I was just going to say that.
I'm sorry.
There's something creepy to me about his wife's role, as Jim just said, as a headhunter for attorneys in law firms that have business before the court, because she's made a lot of money. But even if she didn't make a lot of money, you know, I know you don't want to have the spouse to give up your whole career, but maybe if your spouse is a Supreme Court justice, you have to make some adjustments you wouldn't otherwise make. And I don't think she should be doing what she's doing.
I think you're right. And I think part, you know, when I say it's gobsmacking that he's content to preside over a court with such glaring credibility problems, I think a part of the reason why he is only at this stage in 2023 talking prospectively is because he has something to hide. He has something to lose here.
Yeah.
If the same ethical standards apply to the SCOTUS as applied to other judges and lawyers, you know, across the country, then he will lose out. And I think that's in some ways the most damning thing, because he is clearly elevating his interests and those of nine people above the history of the court, the legacy of even of his job as Chief Justice, but the legacy of the court, the court's credibility. And it really is just it's breathtaking and infuriating that he thinks this is okay.
You know, one last thing. I know when I do things like this, there are people out there that said, you know, get over it, Jim, move on. But I can't. Are you still amazed, troubled, befuddled by the fact that the three liberals in the Supreme Court signed on to that insane statement submitted to the Senate Judiciary Committee by John Roberts, signed, approved by all nine justices, basically saying nothing to see here? I mean, one of the reasons why so far he has gotten away with this is the only counter voices are Democrats in Congress. The power of a Sotomayor or a Kagan or a Ketanji Brown Jackson, in my opinion, a fellow jurist, would be huge if they, you know, did it. I mean, I'm not wrong, am I?
No. I would say not entirely. I actually agree with you, and I was not happy that they all signed on to it. What I thought was the three liberal justices should have written concurring opinion letters to attach to that. In other words, saying, here's the reason.
Yeah.
They have separation of powers problems, where if you let an incursion happen in one instance, then you are opening the door, the slippery slope argument. And if that was the reason that they signed on, they should have made that clear. But you're also talking about of all of the institutions in our democracy, the SCOTUS is easily the most sort of secretive and impenetrable in a lot of ways. And, and they are upholding that tradition.
You know, I should mention here, a texter reminded me, too, to point this out. The Supreme Court just ruled. It was just reported like in the last
today.
Couple of hours. Yeah, in the midst of this climate disaster, and we're talking about the Colorado River running out of water, people running out of water, all these places all around the country, including right here in Massachusetts, Cape Cod, the groundwater being so polluted that people can't drink it. They have just made a ruling that will make it even harder for the Environmental Protection Agency to protect water in the environment.
Yeah.
So they've really hurt the Clean Water Act from 1972.
Right. They ruled in favor of a property owner who wants to develop their own property that they own, but that a strip of which is wetlands.
Yes.
I was actually going to bring up that case because I just read the story saying here he's talking about, you know, how much he follows in the footsteps of his mentor. And there they are, even today, flying in the face of their own precedent on these kinds of issues and flying in the face of federal law. And it's not the first time they've ruled in favor of less regulation other than more with a conservative majority like this.
I mean, that is really scary. When you talk about wetlands, I certainly hope the Commonwealth of Massachusetts can do something about that protection of wetlands because it's crucial. And if we're not going to protect wetlands, we're really sunk. I mean, we're really...
It literally changed the definition of wetlands.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, my blood pressure is going through the roof. Let's move on here. We talked about Ron DeSantis debacle last night, and you're welcome to weigh in on that. But we wanted to talk about something that's going on down in his state, Florida, that these bunch of Chinese citizens have sued Florida over this law that bans Chinese nationals from buying property in large swaths of the state. What do you think? Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that they're suing. I think they're suing, and the ACLU sort of weighed in to explain it. I don't know if the ACLU they'll probably file an amicus brief. But I don't think that they're representing these individual people, but good for them for suing. And essentially, you know, excluding the purchase the private purchase of property, just generally, if it's a large swath of land, particularly if it's near critical infrastructure or a military installation and all of that other kind of stuff, on its face sort of strikes one as unconstitutional. Certainly there's been no showing before these particular lawmakers that the mere purchase of that property or even how that property is intended to be developed presents a threat. So they simply basically singled out the Chinese. And these are individual Chinese people. These aren't Chinese corporations. These are individual people. They basically singled out the Chinese, much like exclusionary acts of old, congressional exclusionary acts of old excluded certain groups, and basically said, you can't do this.
Well, also, but the implications, and I think this is argued by the Civil Liberties Union or the plaintiffs themselves, is it's not just the argument that Andrew Cabral is advancing, but the chilling effect it has not on Chinese nationals, but on Chinese Americans.
Citizens.
In their state. And I find that that's how they celebrate,
Asian Americans in general.
AAPI Month, Heritage Month in Ron DeSantis's Florida. So we'll see. You know, there's another case that I don't mean to rank things, and so don't get angry, anybody. I'm not saying the clean water thing is not important. And obviously this barring of Chinese nationals is important. But there's a case out of Kentucky that is huge where there's this guy. What's the problem, Marjorie? There's a guy in Kentucky who's been accused of shooting his roommate, which is in general not a good thing. I'm not saying
good.
You should shoot your roommate.
Not good.
But and there's a huge however here. He shot his roommate because his roommate allegedly, I don't know this firsthand, ate the last Hot Pocket in their house. Now, did you have roommates when you were in college, Andrew Cabral?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
So if there's something, like I'm a big Hot Pocket fan, I should say. If you craved, well, pick whatever it is you cared about when you're in college. You craved a Hot Pocket and you go in the refrigerator, eat the freezer to get a Hot Pocket and it's gone and you find out your roommate has taken it.
Yeah.
Maybe you wouldn't shoot your roommate, but it is pretty bad. Is it not? Feel free to be honest. Well, here.
You know, I remember back in the day when a stabbing would be sufficient, but apparently we're in a different world now. Yeah, I mean, but this is, you know, all of these stories are really the one thing that they
this
all
is
have.
True, by the way. Go ahead.
There was a guy, again, in Florida.
Florida man.
Who pulled a semi-automatic weapon, handgun, on a guy in front of him who was at the ATM for taking too long. I was at the drive-through ATM.
Yeah.
He went to go to the, he forgot that his deposit slips were in the trunk.
Yeah.
He had to get out of the car to go. And this guy literally starts honking the horn at him and then pulls out a semi-automatic handgun. Yeah. And what that case, the Kentucky case, and all of these other cases that we're seeing have in common is people's ready access to guns in moments when they are angry. And if you have a gun when you're angry, you are much more likely to use it.
Well, why didn't that? Wait. Why didn't the guy you conveniently ignored? Why didn't the guy have the deposit slips in the glove compartment so he didn't need to go to the trunk? It wouldn't have taken that much time.
Well, I'm sure the gun wielding guy's defense will be he had it coming because he didn't
exactly.
have.
Now, hold on for a second. But
you were totally right, by the way. I mean, that is the moral of all these stories.
Mr. Hot Pocket, though, the benefits
here. Mr. Williams to you.
Mr. Williams, that's right. Clifton Williams, Mr. Hot Pocket guy. Yeah. So what he did was he didn't take the gun immediately.
What did he do?
He began by throwing tiles at the guy who ate the last
pocket. So he tried an alternative.
He tried the tiles, and then that didn't work out because the guy that ate the Hot Pocket apparently fought back, and then he left the apartment, at which point Williams got a gun and followed him outside.
By the way, see where he shot him? He didn't
shoot
him.
In the rear end.
Right, he shot him in the buttocks.
He shot him in the buttocks.
In
that's
that
right.
story. So it wasn't like he was trying to kill him.
That's where the remnants of the Hot Pocket were.
That's right.
You know, before you go here, by the way, these are both real stories. Feel free to check them out. I hesitate to ask you this because we only have 2 minutes left, and I can't imagine you answering this in less than 200 minutes. What was your reaction to the misfortune of Governor DeSantis last night there, Andrew Cabral?
Metaphor for his entire existence and more particularly his campaign. What happened is exactly what should have happened. And he is, you know, disaster is what they were.
Well,
they were tweeting.
You've run for office, so you have, and I have too, and Marjorie should.
I don't think so.
Well, you haven't yet. You never
I
know.
I will not be running for anything.
I am of the, we had this discussion with E.J. Dion at the top of the show from the Washington Post, pretty savvy political analyst, about how long a shelf life this has in his campaign. And I think because he's been on the decline in the polls head-to-head with Trump, so much of late that his kickoff was even more important than it is for the traditional candidate. And if he can't get through the ridicule of the first week or so, he's not going to quit, but he could be cooked. Is that too extreme an analysis in your judgment?
No, I don't think so, because the viral nature of social media and everybody's opinions and that sort of weighing in. But I also think that even if it did nothing else, it causes people to just look at him more carefully. He doesn't have really a shelf life, except with extremists, beyond Florida, which is rapidly turning into a haven for fascism and racism and everything else. I mean, in addition to everything else, they're banning books. So, you know, I'm glad that this happened. I won't hide the fact that I'm gleeful that he had a disastrous announcement, because he is worse than Trump in some ways, and it takes a lot for me to get to the point where I think that's an accurate statement.
Yeah, there are rumors, they're unconfirmed, so we're not going to get into it, is one of the reasons for the chaos is Elon Musk took his Hot Pocket. But I don't have any confirmation, so I won't say that on air until we have some confirmation from a responsible, reliable source.
Andrew Cabral, thank
nice
you very
you.
Much.
Goodbye,
thank
Andrew
you.
Cabral. See you soon.
We've been speaking with
Can
Andrew Cabral.
Can you imagine
Cabral.
Shooting your room? I mean, in all seriousness.
Shooting my roommate over a Hot Pocket? No.
By the way, I come here someday. I have a case of seltzer on the shelf, as you know here. Mm-hmm. And occasionally someone takes the last one. And
yes.
I cannot tell a lie. I don't mind if people take them. I mind if they don't replace them.
Mm-hmm.
And that does get me upset. But it doesn't. The point I'm trying to make, and there is a point to this,
yes.
is I don't get upset to the point where I'd get a weapon.
No,
I
don't.
And use it on somebody.
I don't.
I get a little angry.
I get agitated about the purloined paper towels, Jim.
Oh, that's a problem. Well, actually, We know who took the paper towels.
We do.
And he's a relatively prominent person in this town. Very successful.
Because he couldn't stand the mess in our studio.
But we will not name him unless he outs himself.
He came in with a big thing of disinfectant.
He did. That's what he told me the other day.
And took all our paper towels.
He did.
Okay, we've been speaking with Andrew
Cabral. We're not happy about it.
Nope.
Exactly.
Nope. Former Suffolk County Sheriff.
And we have long memories on this show for those who take our paper towels.
And former Secretary of Public Safety in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Andrew Cabral, joins us every week. After a quick break, the legendary actor, comic, singer, stand-up comedian Sandra Bernhard has a one-woman show coming to City Winery. She's going to join us next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And we're live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. And we'll be joined by Governor Healey. The governor will be with us from 1 to 2 at the library to take your questions, calls, all that sort of thing. We're joined now on Zoom by comedian, actor, singer, a whole lot of things, Sandra Bernhard. Her one-woman show, Spring Affairs, coming to City Winery, Boston, next Friday. It's June 2nd. For more info and to book your tickets, you just go to citywinery.com/Boston. Sandra, we're thrilled to have you here. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, a big thrill to talk to you, Sandra Bernhard. So let's start with what's going on at the City Winery. Tell us about what you're going to be doing there, what Spring Affair is all about.
Well, you know, like all my shows, it kind of deals with, you know, my personal anecdotal stories. And then, you know, all woven in and out of music. I'll be there with my musical director and actually two local musicians out of Boston on drums and guitar. So, you know, it's always fun to work with new people who are talented and, you know, and bring their own vibe to the show. And, you know, it's just, you know, reflective of kind of all the years I've been performing and all the sort of approach that I take to my performing. It's, you know, it's a blend and a mashup of comedy, rock and roll, satire, social commentary, and all the things that, you know, people need to hear about in the kind of crazy world we're living in. Hopefully I can help people navigate through it in a funny, uplifting, upbeat way.
But isn't it going to be hard to be upbeat after DeSantis's technical snafu tonight, last night? It's hard to get over, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, we're all heartbroken, but we'll somehow pull ourselves back up by our bootstraps.
Well, Sandra Bernhard, speaking of navigating through, I just wonder if you're going to work in one of my favorite lines that I heard you say, without you, I'm nothing. With you, I'm not much better. That's been a motto for millions of us over the years.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, that was from that show, Without You, I'm Nothing. So,
yes.
I mean, I've done a few shows and a few performances since then, but fortunately I try to keep everything fresh and new and, you know, reflective and of the times we're living in. Like I said, I don't know. They don't seem to be getting much better, unfortunately, but I mean, we do the best we can.
You know,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Marjorie.
I also wanted to ask you because I heard you mention Tina Turner in some of the stand-up you did.
Tweeted about it yesterday, too.
Yes,
and
did a performance of Proud Mary with the Sandra Bernhard style. Tell us what you said about her.
Well, I mean, I've been a fan of Tina since I was a kid, you know, when she was still with Ike. And she is, she's kind of everything to me. You know, she not only is she the ultimate performer and entertainer, but she was, in her own way, you know, a social justice warrior for women, for black women, for women who've been abused and taken advantage of. And she rose above that. And she was such an incredible example for so many women. And she was just her perseverance and her talent just, you know, coincided and took her to places that nobody had ever gone before. And to see her live, which I did several times, was just it was like a five alarm fire. It was explosive and beautiful and moving and exciting and dynamic and otherworldly. And, you know, and I've tried to like learn from people like her about, you know, the commitment to every time you walk on stage of giving it your all. And which is what she did. And, you know, it's just, I'm just terribly sad that she's gone.
You know, I thought I sort of knew the whole Tina Turner catalog. And I'm embarrassed to say when I was on your Twitter page today, you referenced one of your favorite covers. And it seems to me the last thing anyone should ever try to cover is a Beatles song. And you linked to her doing Help, which is one of the greatest things I've ever heard.
I know
anybody do. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
It's shocking. It's gut wrenching. It takes the song and completely turns it on its ear. It's just that's what she was a songstress, an interpreter, you know, an actress. She could and one of the greatest vocalists of all time. So she, with all those things combined, she could take a standard song and turn it into a story that was, you know, reflective of her life and her experience and her time. So, no, very few people can do that.
We're talking to Sandra Bernhardt. She's going to be at the City Winery Boston next Friday, June 2nd. You know, speaking of great vocalists, I have to say, I told Marjorie this morning, that if I had to rate my five favorite scenes in a movie in my whole life, and I've had a fairly long one, among the five would be you singing a haunting rendition of Ray Charles' Come Rain or Come Shine. Here's a little bit of that.
I'm with you, rain or shine.
And for those who are wondering, where did Sarah Bernhardt do that? She did it in front of a pretty famous guy who was strapped into a chair. That would be Jerry Lewis in King of Comedy. Do you look back? I mean, that was a long time ago. Do you look back on that as one of the great? I mean, I know it involves you, so it's probably hard to be objective. Is that not one of the great moments, like, ever? For you, I mean.
Well, it was certainly the beginning of many great moments, you know. It was kind of like the kickoff for my career, even though I'd done some other stuff before. I mean, I'd already been performing since 1975. So that was, you know, that was a huge jumping off place for me. But there's been so many things I've done over the years, you know, my own one woman shows, Without You, I'm Nothing, that turned into a film.
Mm-hmm.
And just all the other things I've been doing recently, you know, my appearance on Pose and American Horror Story, my writing, my live performance, everything has, you know, just sort of been a layer upon layer of things I've been proud of. And I, you know, I like to think I'm kind of artist who doesn't really sell out or do things that are embarrassing or sullies, you know, my work. And it's a hard line to straddle because of course you want to make money. You want to, you know, you want to be successful, but I never want to, you know, kind of bring shame to what I've established as an artist. So that, you know, that's important to me.
Sandra Bernhardt, for people who may not know, tell them about Pose and Nurse Judy.
Well, I mean, Pose is an incredible show that was kind of an homage to the trans movement in the 80s here in New York City, the ballroom scene. And my character plays a nurse in the AIDS ward because everything sort of kind of fell together at that time, you know, the establishment of, you know, that whole scene and then the devastation of AIDS, which sort of leveled, you know, the creative scene in New York in every way, that the actors, the dancers. So, you know, she's a very compassionate but very strong character. And it was just a great, you know, having lived through that time, having lost a lot of friends to AIDS, it was a very, very interesting full circle experience. And to work with all these trans actors, of course, was also very inspiring because, you know, at that time, trans women were not, you know, they were totally marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
And now so many are stars, like my friend MJ Rodriguez. And, you know, it's just exciting. It's an exciting time. And if it wasn't for the cheap politics of our times, things would already have gone and elevated to another level. But people like Ron DeSantis, you mentioned before, and of course our former president, have used it as a cudgel, you know, in these culture wars, which is just a waste of everybody's time. And nobody really cares. People aren't really threatened by drag or trans or you know, exciting, you know, elements of the evolution of the LGBTQI culture. And it's embarrassing. It puts us behind light years where we had already come to. Of course, you know, the abortion issue, which every day, every time you get on the internet or turn on your TV, that there's some other horror story about a woman who's trying to, like, you know, take care of her health and now at risk of going to jail. I mean, it's just we've just gone into a dark place in this country.
You know, you talked about abortion as the number one issue for you. How do you do that in your shows?
Well, I kind of weave it. I weave it in and out, and I can't explain how I do it, because it's sort of, then I would be actually doing pieces from my show, which I don't want to do. I want people to come see them. But, you know, there's ways of handling almost everything. I mean, sometimes I get serious in my shows, but usually I find a way of, like, you know, exploring the underbelly of the people that do it and are against it and create this havoc. But, you know, it's not easy to, like, keep it comedic at this time, but I managed to do it.
You know, what's an audience do for you? I mean, I don't know if I said this before, or maybe I said it. You know, every time I read about your one woman shows, every other description is the goddess of the one woman show. The goddess of, what is that? I know what it does for the audience. What does it do for you?
Well, I mean, obviously, without an audience, you're working in a void, and I feel like I have a very, very tight relationship with the people who've been coming to see me for years, and new people who are listening to me on my SiriusXM radio show Sandyland. You know, people call in, and so I know that I have a lot of new fans and people who didn't understand sort of where I was coming from, but now have developed this relationship. And it's, you know, it's a very give and take thing to be a performer. You know, I mean, I'm sure somebody like Tina Turner, her life, you know, changed completely when she was a solo artist, because people finally, she had the love and the camaraderie of the audience that brought her up. And it gives you a lot of energy, you know, when people are there and they're excited and you see them. I mean, it's inspiring.
We're talking to Sandra Bernhardt, actor, singer, comedian. Sandyland, I think, what's it been, 8 or 9 years? I mean, it's been on radio for quite some time,
no.
Right?
6 or 7. I mean, I think it's, yeah, it's okay. I mean, you know, I mean, it doesn't really matter, but yeah.
Well, that's a long time. That's a long time in the radio business. So give people a sense of what Sandyland's about.
Well, it's an hour show. I only do it once a week now. I'm actually on Thursdays today. Well, it's not Thursday now, but on Thursdays. I open with a song, and today will be Tina Turner Day, so I'll open with all her songs and then play her songs throughout. I do an opening monologue as if I was on stage that I improvise. I take phone calls, and then I have a guest. So, you know, I usually have somebody I like to have on. I never have people on that I'm not sure will be fun to talk to. Occasionally there's been, you know, there's been people that I haven't really connected with, but I try to always have somebody on that I believe in as an artist, or whatever they've written or whatever they're promoting, I feel good about. I don't just have people on as a gimmick. So that's really important to me.
So who are some of your favorites you've had?
Well, I mean, people that are my regulars are people like Liz Winstead from the Abortion Front Access, who's an amazing, brilliant person. My friend Judy Gold, Isaac Mizrahi, Robert Verdi. I have a whole litany of people who are friends, but creative friends, and friends that I can just sink right into a great conversation with.
I'm trying to think, as Sandra Bernhardt said, she doesn't have people on just as a gimmick. Do we have people on just as a gimmick, Margaret?
Yes, we do.
I'm afraid from time to time we are not quite as principled as Ms. Bernhardt here.
Well, I mean, you guys have a different, you have a different setup. First of all, you're not, I mean, you're not celebrities or people that have established a certain, you know, profile. I mean,
we haven't. What?
Sandra, Jim thinks he has.
Wait, we're not we're not nobody. I mean,
don't upset him.
Go ahead, Sandra. I'm sorry.
I don't mean it like that.
Okay,
I mean,
fine.
It's okay.
Occasionally, you're going to have somebody on you don't want to have on. And isn't this National Public Radio?
It's Greater Boston. It's New England. Yeah.
We wish we were national, okay. Sandra. It hasn't happened yet. You know, we're still right here in Boston.
But it's public radio.
Yes, it is public radio.
Yeah, have I gotten that, at least that much information?
You did. That part is correct. That is correct.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a rocky morning here. So I'm glad to hear that. I love public radio. I'm a huge supporter of public radio. And I love it wherever I go. And it's so important. And it's kind of like the last bastion of places for performers and artists to go and talk and not be railroaded into these, you know, sort of asinine conversations that people want to have. So thank you for doing what you're doing and sort of like, you know, keeping your part of the bargain. I really appreciate it.
Well, you've redeemed yourself, Sandra Bernhardt. I want to make
clear
right
Sandra
there.
Sandra Bernhardt, I should have asked you this when we were talking about Pose, but since I screwed that up, we're going to go backwards here, which you almost never do. And just before we go, playing a little sound of you singing a cover of Prince's Sometimes It Snows in April.
Another great song.
On the FX show.
You guys have really done your homework.
We try. Here is Sometimes It Snows in April.
Sometimes it snows.
You should have that misogynist Jerry Lewis tied into a chair for that one, too, Sandra Bernhardt. Whatever.
Yes. I think I tortured him quite enough.
I hope you did.
Good.
Hey, Sandra Bernhardt, good luck on June 2nd. We're thrilled to have you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. Great interview. And I'll see you soon in Boston.
You will
okay,
indeed.
Thank you for all your great work. We've been speaking with Sandra Bernhardt, her one-woman show, Spring Affair, makes its stop at City Winery, Boston, a week from this Friday. That is June 2nd at 8 p.m. If you want to get tickets, and if you do, you're going to love it, go to citywinery.com/Boston. That's citywinery.com/Boston to see the great Sandra Bernhardt. Okay, after a quick break, Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young is here. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Am I on the air, by the way? I am. Okay.
Yes, you are.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the library tomorrow, and Governor Healey joins us tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow, 1 to 2. Before we introduce Shirley, Marjorie, I just want to say to you, I rarely compliment myself, but I really want to, because one of my best qualities, I think you'd agree, is I get over slights. I don't dwell on things. Do you
no, never.
That?
Never.
And
never.
If someone says something that I find, mm-hmm. I don't know, troubling. Mm-hmm. It's just like it's like water on a duck's back.
That's right.
Or whatever
rolls
it is.
Right off.
So if anybody thinks I'm going to keep citing what Sandra Bernhardt just said about us like this, you're crazy.
First of all, you're not celebrities or people that have established a certain, you know, profile.
No, we've only been doing this 25 years. And I would say, maybe if we do it another 30, we'll establish a certain profile in the city, but not quite yet. And by the way, I love Sandra Bernhardt, but Sandra, it's also Thursday. It is Thursday. I want to be clear, despite what you think.
She did say it was a great interview, Jim.
Well, after she humiliated both of us. In any case, you should still go to her show. She's fabulously talented, and I love her. In any case,
she's great.
Yeah, but we have no profile, so why even listening? I mean, why even bother?
Jim, let's move on. Let's move on.
Shirley's here. That's the beauty of it, really.
Waiting to talk.
Marjorie has no profile. I have no profile. We're joined now. Nobody, not on this show. We're joined now on Zoom by Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young. She thinks we have a profile. She joins us weekly. Shirley, it's nice to see you. How are you?
I wouldn't be on the show if you didn't have enough listeners.
Oh, that's right.
A lot of listeners.
Thank you.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, Shirley Young. So you ask an existential question in your column. Is Mayor Michelle Wu giving the cold shoulder to the business community? What's the answer?
The answer is it depends on who you ask or depends on who's answering the question. This is probably like the third or fourth version of this column of, ever since Mayor Wu has been elected, certain segments of the business community feel ignored, largely developers and the real estate community. They don't feel like they're being heard. And so I yet again wanted to address the question, is it just one segment of the business community that's unhappy with Mayor Wu, or is it all the entire business community? So I set out to find members of the business community that that do have a relationship with the mayor, have an open dialogue, and I found a lot of people who said a lot of people in innovation tech. I think the first quote was from Jeff Busgang, who's a Boston venture capitalist. And actually, the three people I quoted in my story, they knew Michelle Wu while she was running for city council the first time. So these relationships go back more than a decade. And they paint a portrait of a mayor who does care about the business community, is proactive, reactive to what's going on in the business community. And I thought that was really important to write a column about this, even though I know there are certain parts of the business community unhappy with Mayor Wu's policies and concerned about the future of the city and the economy. But I think it's important to highlight that there are there are many elements that feel that she's their mayor too.
Well, you said there've been a number of iterations. This is, your former boss, who is now a columnist at the Globe, Brian McGorry, wrote a similar take on this, not the same as you, but a similar one. And his basic message, I surely don't speak for Brian, but I'm sure you read the column, seems to be, get over it. I mean, there's a new sheriff in town. She does business differently. It's fine to disagree or agree with her policies. It's not like she's ignoring anybody. You say it just may not be you don't get the special face-to-face, nobody in the room kind of thing. And I'm with both of you, by the way.
Well, I think made the point that the business community is doing pretty well. Schools are falling apart. The tea's falling apart. That maybe Mayor Wu has some different priorities, and maybe she should.
Well, she also trusts her people. I mean, she's able to delegate, which a lot of egomaniac elected leaders are not able to do. So I think you make a wonderful point, as did Brian.
Right. So, for Brian's call, mine, we're kind of the same, right? It's the same story,
different idea.
One of the things, though, I do think she's heard the criticism, from parts of the business community that they feel ignored or they want more attention. And since January, she's been having these quarterly meetings, group meetings with the association leaders. And it's very interesting because, typically you would focus on the big business organizations, right? Like the chamber. She makes it a bigger table. She brings in the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. She brings in the Asian Business Empowerment Council, which is barely a year old. She brings in Grace Morano from the chamber, the LGBT chamber. So she's building a very inclusive table. She brings in Mass Challenge as well, the tech accelerator. So she's and when you look at that room, there are a lot of women. There are a lot of women of color around the table. If I had a guess, I think the white men are in the minority in that room.
Ooh. Wow.
Well, the white men are in a minority in City Hall, too. People voted for a change in the damn city. And they're getting, I think, what they voted for, at least in my estimation. 87, why am I giving the number? No one's calling. We're talking to Shirley Leung from the Boston Globe.
So, Shirley, a couple of your colleagues at the Globe had actually, this is from Bloomberg, I think.
Is it from Bloomberg? Okay, it is Bloomberg. Yes, it's Bloomberg. Sorry. But I have to say this is probably one of the most obvious stories you could ever imagine. But during the pandemic, many women dropped out of the workforce because they had no child care. They had no school. They couldn't do their jobs and take care of the kids. And now they're back reversing the slump. So I guess this is fairly to be expected.
Well, it wasn't to be expected. Remember when we were reporting and talking about the so-called she session, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of women lost their jobs in 2020 when the economy shut down because of the pandemic, because a lot of them were in hospitality, right? They were in the hotel workers, wait staff. And so a lot of women lost their jobs, or they dropped out completely to take care of their families because the schools and daycares were shut down. And back then, we weren't sure if they would come back. And if they came back, would they come back at a lower pay scale or and they have to take a lesser job? It would hurt them in terms of advancement. But it's good to hear that the number of women, it's a record, participation of women, it's 77.5%, a record since the government started taking data and tracking data. And it reflects kind of other trends, which is more women have college degrees now, right? They're graduating with college degrees. And also that it reflects a fairly strong job market. And so there's still a lot of jobs out there. And so they need the employers need everybody they can get. And also the other thing is that we still have relatively high inflation.
Exactly.
So,
they have to.
A lot of families, right, need that second income. And also government aid, that was given out during pandemic, that's also disappeared too. So I think a lot of women, it's great that a lot of women are back at work. And there are still relatively a good number of jobs out there. Now the question is, right, like we talked about last thing, now it's pay equity, right? Make sure that they're being paid as much as the men, if not more, maybe, or much, I guess I should say, as much as the men, and they continue to advance.
Well, there's also another question, and let's get back to something that was written in the Globe. The headline of the piece is, from college to the working world, a hybrid life has become the norm for many 20-somethings. That's your colleague, Didi Coley. And again, I think we know that, but she digs deep into this thing. The one place, and I know, again, the second time today I said I'm Johnny OneNote, but I really feel strongly about this. She goes on to write, still the long-term effects of remote work on young employees is an open question. And while obviously we don't know for sure because we haven't lived in the future yet, is there anybody
you deal with?
That's a very deep point I made. Thank you. As to the future, only time will tell. Chuck Curtis always used to say to me, says that's how we should end it. As for the future, only time will tell. In any case, while we don't know, Shirley, it's pretty obvious to me that as much as hybrid work may suit the needs and desires of a 20-something today, by definition, that person is not getting the mentorship that I know from my own life, I know from Marjorie's, because we talked about this ad nauseum, without which I don't think we would have been even moderately successful in the things we have done. Is there, in the world in which you travel and the people with whom you talk, is there any doubt that even if you do have to accommodate young people's work-related demands now, that there's a tsunami of problems coming down the line? Is that accepted, or am I an outlier?
No, I think that is something that employers talk about and Gen Z workers talk about. I actually think, Didi quoted in her story a survey that said that like 40% of Gen Z workers, they prefer
in-person. Yeah.
And it's really the hybrid workplace that the employer has that has them at home. I mean, it was remarkable about Didi's stories. It was actually kind of sad, right?
Like, was sad. Yeah.
The lead of the 20 something year old who wakes up, rolls over, logs on. Her yeah. office is her bedroom. Her bedroom is her office.
Yeah.
When you're young, you tend to live in tiny apartments. You have many roommates. When you're older, more established, you can go to a house, right? You can spread out a little bit. And so it seemed like a sad life. And I think in our story, too, there were some, recent graduates who said, I will only take a job.
Yeah.
It's in person. And I think that's very smart. And so I think the onus is on employers, who have hybrid workplaces to be more intentional, right, of making sure your Gen Z workers have more mentorship. And there are already surveys that show that in this hybrid workplace, what happens is that the newer employees, the younger employees, they get overlooked by their managers because, they're out of sight, out of mind.
You know, I'm not exactly, I think Marjorie would agree, this is a fun kind of person. But having said that, the most fun I've had in a fairly long checkered career, some good, some bad, is spending time with my coworkers. I mean, whether it's doing work with other people, whether it's laughing with other people, whether it's going out for a drink. And it's just I really have incredibly strong feelings about this. I know it upsets a lot of my younger coworkers, but I think in the long run, they've missed out on something that is critical to career development, so.
Well, you also don't have the office friends.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And going out for, and you know what's weird? When you do go to some event that everybody has to show up at because it's some big deal at your company, and you walk in there and you don't recognize so many of the people that are there. You've never seen them before because you haven't seen them, even maybe on Zoom, right?
Yeah, no, that's happened to me. But do you guys remember there was an opinion piece that ran last year from, a 20-something, someone in their late 20s. And she says that she thinks it's healthy that that her friends are not office workers.
Yes.
From office. And that the baby boomers and Gen Xers, it wasn't healthy that we had so many friends at the office, that it's actually good to kind of diversify our friendship.
But they're not mutually exclusive, right? Right?
Right, right, right. No, some of my best friends are from work.
Me too. Me too. Yeah.
Does that include me or not?
Oh, absolutely, Jim.
I just want to be clear.
Just absolutely,
my
Jim.
My ego was destroyed in the last interview.
Well, so by the way.
It depends on the day, Marjorie. Depends on the day, right? Depends on the day. Depends on the week.
We're just getting an email. We're getting a lot of text about your being upset, Jim, that what? You're not a big celebrity.
No, I don't even have a profile.
It's one texter says, you are enough of a celebrity to be in a smug mug. There
well,
you go.
That's a very good point.
And then. Okay. Before this other one says, before Sandra Bernhardt even finished the thought saying you weren't a celebrity, this texter, Peter from Mystic, knew Jim was going to freak out.
Well, the beauty is, as I say, I've totally gotten over it.
You sure heard during the break. During the break.
And how about the next break?
We almost had to get him down off the ceiling, Shirley.
They're calling an EMT, actually, for me. So, Shirley,
and it's hard to get him up on the ceiling. You know what I mean?
You wrote a wonderful column today. There's so little good news that I hate to sound trite, like I know Arun in the afternoon tries to focus on a piece of it, and good for him. You write a story. Obviously, it's AAPI, Cultural Heritage Month, as we know. Yeah. And you write a piece about an initiative from Ayanna Pressley involving somebody I'm afraid a lot of people don't know or didn't know, Caroline Chang. Talk about her and what Congresswoman Pressley's trying to do.
So Caroline Chang is part of a generation of kind of Asian Americans in Boston who really fought for the rights of the community starting in the 70s, right? And she founded some of the seminal organizations. She grew up in Chinatown. She founded, South Cove Health Center. She founded the Asian Development Corporation. Asian Community Development Corporation, the Asian American Civics Association, I think also the Chinese Historical Society of New England.
She was incredible.
And anyway, so she was, she'd been around for many decades. She passed away in 2018 at the age of 77. And Ayanna Pressley, Congresswoman Pressley, you know, she wanted to find a way to mark the Asian American Pacific Heritage Month. And when I spoke to her, she said, you know, she really believes that, you know, there should be parity and you know, people of color, women, on buildings, on monuments, statues. We need to be part of that too. Mm-hmm. And so she had this idea. I want to rename a post office in my district. And it happens to be the kind of main post office in South Station. And so she, you know, asked the Asian American community, whose name should grace this post office. And they came to her and said, we think Carolyn Chang would be worthy. And so she filed a bill today, rename, this post office, the Carolyn Chang, post office. She would be the first, you know, I didn't even know, you know, the process, right, of that post offices had name, but there's like 617 federal post offices in Massachusetts. 17 have been renamed. Of those, I think only one has been renamed. You know, a woman has a woman's name on it. Only five are people of color, a person of color, named after a person of color. So she would be the first woman of color and the first Asian American to have her name, a post office named after her, and also I think the first federal building in Massachusetts named after an Asian American.
You know, I read your story. I loved it. I loved every single part of it, the concept, the history making. I love reading about a woman I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't heard about and what she'd achieved. However, when I read it a second time, because I said something doesn't work here, and I realized it's the South Station Post Office. And I said to myself, since we're talking about naming a facility, do you know what the name of the South Station itself is, either of you?
Dukakis.
So it's called the Michael S. Dukakis South Station Transportation
right.
Center.
Very good.
So what did I do? I went to the website for South Station. And I only had 5 minutes. In 5 minutes, I could find no reference to the name of Michael S. Dukakis, after whom the thing is. Now, I know he wasn't crazy about it. He said, I much prefer North-South Rail to having my name on something, whatever it was. But the reason I bring that up is not to complain about that. That's his business. I worry that unless part of the naming thing is some sort of mandate. I know Marjorie hates mandates. Did you always say it's not the South Station Post Office, but the Carolyn Chang South Station Post Office? You know what I mean?
It's funny you should mention that, because
why?
Actually, I think the bill, I think the bill outlines it. You know, you have to redo the maps. You have to make sure the maps have this name now on it. And so.
Oh, really?
And,
oh, well, good.
Yeah,
for her.
I think there is a, you know, I don't know if, you know, right. It'll have its name on. You have to redo the maps. You have to make sure that this name will be there. I thought you were going to mention about the South Station expansion.
No, go. Oh, that's a good point. That's right.
Because that was the first thing I had because that post, because.
That's a very good point.
That office has been in the news.
That's right.
Because, you know, the state wants the U.S. Postal Service to move from
right.
South Station so they can expand. And so I asked about that. So, well, first
what
of all,
happen?
What would happen? Well, first of all, it's there. The post office, there's a part that's more the, you know, customers go, you do mail. But then there's like a massive sorting facility.
Yeah.
So, but I was told that if the post office moves, the name will move with it. I mean, I have to think that there will be some kind of post office presence there. Perhaps the sorting facility mm-hmm. will actually move somewhere far away. But it seems like South Station there should be some post office for people to use at South Station. But anyways, the name is good.
We agree.
I want to move on to something I'm very excited about.
I am too.
Tell us about View Boston. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, View Boston.
Yes, View Boston.
I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't even heard of it.
Neither had I, but I'm so excited about this. Tell us what's happening on the top of the Prudential Tower.
Right. So there used to be what is the top of the hub, right? There used to be a restaurant at the top of the Prudential Center, and that closed in 2020. And I think all along, you know, the owners of the building, they were going to build an observatory there. And if you walk along the Prue Mall, you can see, I mean, there's been signage, you know, view Boston coming, because on one of the floors, I believe they took over the Microsoft store closed during the pandemic.
That's the entrance.
That's the entrance. So you'll see it walking at the Prudential Mall level. You can walk in and, you know, I was surprised. So you just go to the top. Now you go to the top of the Prudential Center and they've built this apparently amazing observatory deck, outdoor deck. There's also like an immersive tour of the city. And I asked my colleague, Catherine Carlock, who got a sneak peek, because it costs money. It's about $35 per ticket. And I said, is it worth it? And she said, yes, it is. It is pretty spectacular. And if you think about it, other cities have this now, you know, whether it's New York City or Seattle or and so I'm glad we're adding this. And I mean, I'm hoping this will, I mean, Catherine was saying that certainly tourists will go to it, but she thinks that they built it in such a way that's also attractive to locals as well. So
it's got cocktails. Cocktails.
Yeah, one floor down or something, right?
One floor down. Yeah.
Right, right. There's a restaurant, there's cocktails, there's a bistro. You know, I was surprised how much they spent on it. It was $182 million.
I know. They better have a lot of people walking through the old Microsoft entrance. You know, by the way, attached to the Globe story are some beautiful photographs. I mean, really spectacular photographs of the city. Does our buddy Jack Connor still have the top floor?
No, he's
office.
Moved from there.
He's moved from Hancock.
He moved to Newbury Street now.
Yeah,
he moved to Newbury
Street. Talk about
Street.
A view. That was one hell of a...
Yeah, the top of the Hancock Tower. They closed that after 9/11, I think, right?
Was it? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
they did.
I think so.
Okay, well, Shirley, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, children, you know, react differently to things. I remember my son, after 9/11, was obsessed with tall buildings. We spent hours drinking Coca-Colas at the top
Empire
of
the State Building, you said. I thought you went to the Empire State Building all the time.
We went to the Empire State Building like five times. One day I was there for 6 hours, freezing to death. At least you can go inside the Empire State Building. Yeah, this is how we coped with 9/11 obsession with tall buildings. But we were at the Hub, you know, top of the Hub, not having dinner, but you could drink a Coca-Cola be in the cocktail lounge there. And I've logged hours up there, so I'm really glad I can get back there and enjoy it again.
Did that close because of the pandemic, I assume? I don't even know.
I think the restaurant, I thought they closed.
I don't know.
Okay.
The lease ended in 2020, just prior to the COVID pandemic.
Oh, okay, lease ended. Okay, well, let's check out View Boston. Sounds great to me. Shirley, it's great to see you. Be well.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shirley Leung. Always great to talk to you. Okay, we've been talking with Boston business columnist Shirley Leung, who joins us every week, and we're very grateful that she does. You can read all her columns in the Boston Globe. Coming up, PBS European travel guru Rick Steves is coming to town for a special symphonic journey with the Boston Pops. He'll tell us all about that and his recent travels through Spain as well. Rick Steves is next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. We're at the library tomorrow. The governor will join us. Governor Healey will be with us from 1 to 2 to take your questions and calls. But first, we're joined now on Zoom by PBS European travel guru Rick Steves. That would be Rick playing the finale from, oh boy, am I going to blow this, Suite de Danzas Criollas at his home piano. He's warming up for his upcoming Europe, a symphonic journey where he'll team up with the Boston Pops on June 8 and 9. Rick's an author, television, radio host, owner of Rick Steves Europe Tour Group. You can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights at 7:30 on GBH2 and his radio show, Travel with Rick Steves, Sundays at 4 on GBH89.7. Belated happy birthday, Rick Steves.
Well, thank you very much. I was in Spain on my birthday, and as I am almost every birthday, I'm in Europe in May.
Great.
Do they make birthday cakes in your European travel countries, or is that more of an American thing?
You know, I don't recall that many birthday cakes. I recall a lot of wine and a lot of people singing the same tune, but in their own language.
Okay. Okay. So before we get any further, tell us what's going on June 8th and 9th at the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the Boston Pops, I should say, at Symphony Hall.
I'm so excited. I get to fly to Boston, and we're going to have two concerts, and it's called Europe, A Symphonic Journey. And we go to 7 different countries around Europe musically and visually. I've got, I've had my team edit these beautiful video clips for each piece. And I get to set it up like a good tour guide and give you the cultural and historical context. And then we go back to the 1800s, the 19th century, when romanticism and nationalism were buddies, you know. All of these romantic pieces were like bugle calls on the battlefield as different nationalities in Europe carved out their independence. And we can we'll go to Italy and stand on the seats of the opera as everybody would sing the arias together as if singing a forbidden national anthem and calling for Victor Emmanuel to be the king of a united Italy. In fact, his name, Victor Emmanuel, V-E-R-D-I, Verdi, was the composer, yeah. And it stands for Victor Emmanuel Re d'Italia, king of Italy. And there's all of this enthusiasm for countries being independent. And the romantic, you know, music of the era just celebrated that. So we'll go to Norway, we'll go to Czech Republic, we'll go to England, we'll go to France, Germany, we'll do some waltzing in Vienna. And I just love it because I get to set it up like a tour guide would, and we get to look at beautiful images while the wonderful orchestra plays. It's a lot of fun, and we finish with Beethoven's Ode to Joy to celebrate the whole concept of Europe.
So about a couple of weeks ago, Keith Lockhart was actually with us. He's obviously the conductor of the Pops, and he was talking about his collaboration with you. Here's a little piece of it.
We've been talking back and forth for the last few months, and the funniest thing about this was that he went on vacation, but he was still very eager to talk to me. He's very intense. And so he calls me from vacation, and I said, so the very first question is, where does Rick Steves go on vacation? He said, I'm in Arkansas.
Well, there you go. Back from Arkansas. Hey, you know, staying on classical music.
Hold on. Are you very intense, Rick Steves?
Well, when I'm talking about putting together the symphonic journey, apparently I am. There's a lot of moving parts. But we did it a couple of years ago with Boston Pops, and it was so much fun. And it was fun talking with Keith, and we're swapping in different pieces. And we're actually going to go to Spain also, so this is really going to be fun.
You know, one last thing on this. You've told us wonderful stories about the teenager, Rick Steves, going to, I think, Germany with your father to piano factories. Is that where the classical music seed was planted in the young you, or no?
I grew up in a musical family. My dad was a band director and a piano tuner and then a piano importer. And I had to learn the piano. And I really was one of those lucky kids, I think, that really found joy in getting good at the piano. And I saw the value of it. And I was a piano teacher before I was a travel teacher. I just realized when I was a kid, I was still a teenager, kids are not going to practice in the summer. I'm not going to struggle with this. I'm going to Europe. I'll see you in the fall. It just gives your life a whole extra dimension. I just really believe it's a blessing to enjoy music and to be able to play it or appreciate it or whatever. And as you travel and you do the work I do, you do see how music makes sense with what's going on with different cultures, and it goes through the ages. Music, art, architecture, poetry, philosophy, all these things hold hands as they walk through the ages. They're all in the same mindset, Renaissance, Baroque, Romantic, you know, Impressionism, abstract. It's all a big, it's a procession, it's a parade, and the more we understand the whole cultural sweep of it, I think the more fun it is. And that's a fun thing to do with music. So for me to get to stand on stage there in that wonderful, the Symphony Hall?
Symphony Hall, so beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Just inspiration gorgeous. And all these wonderful people and this incredible orchestra. We did it 10 years ago for public television with my volunteer orchestra here in my little town north of Seattle. And bless their hearts, it's a bunch of volunteer musicians, and they just did a great job. But boy, when I stood there with the Boston Pops, I really appreciated what a serious orchestra is all about. It's really great to be able to be part of this. And I'm just so thankful that Keith and the gang at Boston Pops invited me back. And it's going to be, for me, a real celebration.
By the way, bso.org is where you get tickets to join Rick and Keith on the stage and Marjorie and me in the audience.
And I get to give a little half hour, you know, pre-concert talk each evening.
Yes.
People are welcome
yes.
to come in.
Oh, great.
I've got some slides, and I'll just give a little backstory about these pieces we're going to be enjoying together.
Terrific.
You know, in one of the, I think this is on your Facebook page, you talked about being over in Spain and with a couple of your new friends, Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez, his son, and you collaborate on the re-release of The Way, the walk, the Ignatian walk for St. Ignatius. It's a lot of people on their bucket list of what they want to do when they retire. Tell us about The Way and your new friends.
Well, you got to have 30 days for that bucket list check off.
You do. It's long.
A long hike. You got to hike from the Pyrenees all the way to Santiago de Compostela. But it's something that's very popular these days, people trying to get away and find some meaning in their life and get away from the rat race. And a beautiful classic way to do that is to hike this pilgrimage trail across northern Spain. And Martin Sheen and his son Emilio did it in a movie 10 years ago, and they wanted to bring it out again for a one-night showing. And they had this idea to collaborate with me. So they came up to Seattle, and we spent a couple days working on this, and we ended up in a pub talking about the value of travel, kind of in keeping with the TV show I made just during COVID called Why We Travel. And they're both fans of my work. I didn't even know they knew who I was. And they said, oh, we'd be so happy if we could come to your town and film this thing. So we made a 20-minute conversation that we tacked on to the end of the movie. And then it really was a great conversation. They're both kindred spirits when it comes to learning about the world and learning about yourself through travel, leaving your home to learn more about it by looking back at it from a distance and so on. So we made this what turned out to be a 20-minute extra for the show. And it ran in 1,000 theaters a couple of weeks ago, and it did really well. And eventually we'll be able to, well, it's going to be streamable and so on. But it was all this idea about getting away and traveling to just have some time alone to think about why are we on this planet. And, you know, there's all sorts of things going on with artificial intelligence, but there's nothing artificial about just getting away and connecting with the world and realizing what's important in life. And I just thoroughly enjoyed it. They're wonderful people, and it was a great opportunity. And then I went back just this last month and researched my guidebook for Spain. And I'm not quite as on the ball right now as I might be, because I just 2 days ago I was in France enjoying the Riviera and updating my guidebooks there. But it's good to be home. But I had a month, an intense month, where every day I had two guides and I was working day and night on these guidebooks, just getting up to date Europe, get it all post-COVID, figuring out what the restaurants are doing, what the museums are doing, how's the infrastructure, how easy is it to get from Spain to Africa, what about the ways to spend your time best on the French Riviera, and what's the consequence of the rise of Airbnb to neighborhoods that in the past have been really thriving, and now they're just filled with people from other countries that want to buy a slushy. And, there's so much happening, and it's, that is kind of sad, Marjorie. That's a whole other issue. I hate to be a downer, but I'm finding new towns that are not inhabited by short-term rental people, because it just changes the character of a place like Barcelona or Nice or Toledo.
Well, we wanted to talk about one of those towns that you just wrote about, Menton in France, in just a second. But I wanted to ask you, I wasn't clear. You have gone around with these food guys to these different places and different towns to get the skivvy and what's going on there. But is that something that you can actually, if you're a tourist, you can hire a food guide to take you to the best places in any particular locale?
Or you could buy, for the cost of one of those guides, you could buy 40 of my guidebooks and do it yourself and give a guidebook to all your friends. This is what I do, so you don't have to have a food guide with you. But one thing that is very accessible is a food tour. And I love these food tours. And I take the food tours because they're a big part of the experience you can have all over Europe. I mean, literally every place in Europe will have food tours. And it costs $80 or $90. You spend 3 or 4 hours. You go to 5 or 6 different artisanal hole-in-the-wall foodie places. You try things, you walk, you laugh, you drink, you make friends, you have a meal, and you come away from that and you realize, wow, they've got their own proud culture of food in Lisbon or in the French Riviera or Slovenia or Andalusia or Tangier. And I hire a lot of these people to help me go through the town and pick the best restaurants. So each day when I'm working, I have a guide at 10 o'clock that I'm with for 6 hours that we do the city, the sightseeing, the history, all that kind of stuff. And then I take a couple hours, and then I at 7 o'clock or whatever, I meet a local food guide in the evening. And we basically blitz the restaurants. I've got maybe 10 restaurants I recommend in my guidebook for that city. And I want to visit all those, and then I want to find new places and see which ones merit a spot in the next edition of the guidebook, because they come out every year or two.
You know, Rick Steves, I think I speak for a lot of people in the audience to say that my family has probably helped put all of your family through college. And
you know, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank everybody listening.
It's about time you thanked us, yeah. But no, seriously, I've often thought, and you answered the question, I think one of your post things I was reading the other day, I always thought, how do you decide not to update, because I know you're doing that all the time, but to add something totally new? And Marjorie just mentioned it in passing. You wrote about adding Menton, which is always the case with you, sort of the path a little bit less traveled with a lot of the wonderfulness that other more traveled places have. So tell us a little bit about that and the decision you made to expand to include that.
Well, first of all, everybody wants to have that Riviera experience. And the less thoughtful traveler will go to Saint-Tropez because it was in the movies. And Saint-Tropez is the worst place to go if you want to go on the Riviera for an experience. The opposite end of that spectrum would be Menton. Menton is a beloved town for people who live there, but it's not doesn't register on the international travelers list. But the cool thing is, all of the famous towns that you can name on the Riviera, from Monte Carlo in Monaco to Villefranche to Nice to Antibes to Cannes, they're all 15 or 20 minutes apart by this train line. And it's like, to me, a charm bracelet. The train line is the bracelet, and then all these little towns hang on it like little charms. Mm. So like people collect a charm bracelet, and Menton is one of those little dangles on the charm bracelet that people don't get to, but it's on the same $2 bus line or train ticket where you just hop on the train, and in half an hour you get off there instead of Cannes. And, you know, Cannes right now with the film festival is a different sort of beast, and if all you're interested in is, you know, rubbing shoulders with the paparazzi, that's kind of exciting. But if you want to have an affordable salad niçoise on the beach, I'm going to the town next to niçoise. I'm going to next, you know, that's the Nice salad. I'm going to have my salad niçoise in Menton. Menton has a romantic cemetery on the cap of its hill, which used to be a castle that they tore down. It's right on the border of Italy, literally. Louis XIV, the King of France, tore down their castle just preventatively because he didn't like the people on Italian border to have a castle like that. Today it's filled with all of the old romantic tombs. You walk through a beautifully preserved medieval town, and then you have a promenade. And they've turned this promenade, it's got a boardwalk, it's got all sorts of cafes and restaurants and beach chase lounges or whatever. It's a beautiful strolling place for the passeggiata or the stroll in the evening. And it's half the price of Nice, and it doesn't have any tourist crowds. So we visited it. We always had done it as a peripheral site. And my co-author and I, Steve, last week, we went there just to check it briefly. Our guide happened to be from Menton, so she was enthusiastic about it. And we both just realized we've got to beef this coverage up. So we changed our plans. We dedicated a day, each of us there, to finding restaurants and hotels, making a map, and, you know, planning out a guided walk. The one thing that breaks my heart is you get a lot of beautiful, classical, sort of industrial age market halls, you know, from that with the iron and glass and all the little artisans and the bakers and the man who does potatoes and the people who cook the quiche. And it loses its viability because there's not enough local people, and it becomes a tourist zone. And it's still charming, but when you get to a place like Menton, the marketplace still has its basic salt of the earth, you know, community artisans that sell bread to the neighbors as their parents did. And that's alive and well in Menton. So the marketplace is a big attraction. I just love it.
Yeah, but when, you know, it seems to me there's a conundrum, though. There's got to have been a New Yorker cartoon about people in, I don't know, a cathedral in France where everybody, instead of looking at the ceiling, is reading their Rick Steves guidebook. I mean, if there isn't, there should. I mean, we've all had that experience in Europe. But when you write about a place like this, which virtually none of us have heard about, doesn't it almost guarantee that it's going to cause it to be maybe not overpopulated by tourists, but much more populated by tourists, and lose some of its, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It is a kind of a quandary, but I don't have that big of an impact on a place like Menton. I mean, a lot of people, what I'm doing is I'm taking them away from Cannes and Nice, yeah, and I'm spreading them over to places that really can handle the crowds much better. But Nice, it occurred to me, Nice is really on the edge of being too touristy. I love Nice. It's, yeah, a great place. But you walk around Nice, the old quarter, and every restaurant is just dominated by tourism. And you go half an hour away on the train to Menton, and you've got the same beautiful variety and enthusiasm of restaurants and bistros and so on, but you don't see tourists there. That's and, you know, they'd love a few extra tourists. And my job is I'm like the whaler who screams, quick, harpoon it before it's extinct.
That's the voice of Rick Steves, who's going to be at the Boston with the Boston Pops performing on June 8th and June 9th.
You know, Rick Steves, you talked to Christopher Muther, a Globe travel writer, last time you were here in Boston with the Pops. And you talked about in that piece how Americans don't say bon voyage anymore. We say safe trip. Yeah. And you talked about how we've become an afraid nation.
Yeah.
What do you mean by all that?
Well, when I grew up, people said bon voyage. It was a celebration. And now every time I go somewhere, people say have a safe trip. It's an innocent little slip of phrase to me. But I just wish they would say have a good time, not have a safe time. Because, well, for one thing, I know the statistics. And I know that where I'm going is safer than where they're staying. Yeah. And when they tell me have a safe trip, I'm honestly inclined to tell them that, well, you have a safe stay at home. Because where I'm going statistically, and I know statistics are optional these days, but where I'm going statistically is safer than where you're staying. I just stepped onto a ferry in the south of Spain in the shadow of the Rock of Gibraltar. And the ferry leaves every hour. It costs $40. And 45 minutes later, I was in Africa, in Tangier.
Wow.
It was the greatest experience. I made more cultural change, Marjorie and Jim, by taking that 45-minute ferry than I made by flying all the way from Seattle to Spain. And it's just walk up to the window, give them 40 euros, that's $40, get on that ferry, marvel at the place, one of the only places where you can see two seas coming together and two continents at the same time, and sail across that amazing strait and land in Tangier, in a land that doesn't spend any time thinking about the United States, in a Muslim Arab country that loves its king, and see how they have changed in the last generation. It's an amazing story. And I got to settle in there for a few days and have a time of my life, even though I was working, because I know I'm just trying to remind Americans in southern Spain that you can zip over to Morocco for a day. But I just thought there's a lot of people that are afraid. I did it. I'm no different than anybody else. I don't speak French and I don't speak Arabic. I just have a few bucks in my pocket and a guidebook, and I can go to Tangier. It used to be called the armpit of Africa. It used to be a horrible place. And now the king loves Tangier. Tangier is back in the fold, and it's a thriving example of probably the most exciting and stable country, or one of the most exciting and stable countries in Africa. What's not to like about going there and having a bowl of couscous and realizing they don't drink wine here, so I'm going to be dry and have just a pile of memories that you will treasure for the rest of your life. That's travel.
You know, we only have 2 minutes left here, but you mentioned people being afraid. And I think one of the things people are most afraid of is not knowing the language, that they'll be in a place where people won't be able to speak English and they'll be totally flummoxed. What's your advice there?
Well, that may have been a case 40 years ago, but I've been traveling and teaching for 40 years. And during that time, a whole generation has grown up speaking English. There's a big movement in Morocco. There's a big movement, Marjorie, where they don't want French to be their second language anymore. It was colonized by France or something, and it was everybody was learning French in school. And they're all saying, we want to learn English in school. English is the world's linguistic common denominator. If you meet young people, educated people in tourism, and you know how to speak clearly with your English, simple English, lectures about how to speak what the Voice of America calls simple English, you'll do just fine. And I'm a good example of that because I speak only English. Nothing to brag about, but it just is an example of how, you know, you can do fine.
Good.
And in Morocco, anybody can afford a guide. So what I've done is I interviewed five different guides, and I listed my favorite four of them. And, you know, for $50 for a couple of hours, they'll meet you at the ferry. And you've got your own translator, your own comedian, your own shopping assistant, your own historian, and your own guide. And it's also a shield to keep the other guides away from you. So these are really just kind of fun little tips you pick up. But the main thing is, the thing to worry about, if you're worried about safety, the most dangerous thing I can think about is a world where nobody travels. We need to travel. We need to travel now more than ever. This global society has to understand each other. Everybody's got different truths that they find self-evident and God-given. And if there's a call to prayer sweeping across Islam, a billion people from Malaysia to Morocco every time, five times a day, sweeping across that zone with the speed of the turning of the earth. And it says, there's one God and he is great. And if that gives you chills of fear, I think you've been watching too much American commercial news, and you got to get over into Islam and celebrate that cacophony of praise, because this world is a cacophony of civilizations and a cacophony of religions and a cacophony of beautiful people. And if you don't get out there and get to know them, you missed the boat, baby.
So from Tangier to Symphony Hall, we're going to see you on June 8th, and we can't wait, Rick Steves. It's going to be great.
I'm so glad you guys are going to be at the symphony, and I'm just thrilled to be there, and I hope that if anybody, even if you didn't know you liked classical music yet, check it out in the context of the symphonic journey. By the way, a lot of people can't make it, and I should remind them that on my website is the one-hour TV show we did with this same symphony 10 years ago.
Great.
People can go to ricksteves.com, go into the TV section, and watch the symphonic journey and have a glimpse of what we'd be doing live and in person right there in Symphony Hall.
We'll be there live and in person. Rick, it's great to see you. And again, happy birthday.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thanks so much. All right.
Great to talk to you as always. Rick Steves is an author, TV and radio host, the owner of Rick Steves Europe Tour Group. You can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights at 7:30 right here on GBH2, plus his radio show, Travel with Rick Steves, every Sunday at 4 o'clock on GBH 89.7 FM, Rick Steves Europe, a symphonic journey, where he teams up with the BSO, is June 8th and June 9th. You can get tickets for what's going to be a great evening at bso.org/pops. Coming up. Thank you so much, Rick. Talk to you soon.
Great to see you, Rick. See you in a week or so. Be well.
Happy travels.
Yes. Coming up, we'll open the lines to get your reflections on the legendary Tina Turner, who has just passed away. The number is 877-301-8970. Your memories and some of her music. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Can't believe I'm talking over Tina Turner. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, live at the library tomorrow. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. Well, here's your opportunity to pay tribute to one of the few people in the world who really was larger than life. The late, great Tina Turner just died at 83. The town, of course, is from her 1971 mega hit, Proud Mary. A life of overcoming racism, domestic abuse, expectations about a woman, aging in the music industry with immense talent and courage and all this incredible stuff. Tributes have come in today. You've seen them from the Bidens, Michelle Obama, Mick Jagger, Beyonce. Earlier, we were talking on the radio show here with Sandra Bernhard, called her the ultimate entertainer. In a couple of minutes, I'm pretty excited about this, we're going to talk to a local guy from Reading who's a saxophone player who toured the world with her and did hundreds of shows with Tina Turner. So stick around for that. But first, here's your opportunity. Tell us what she meant to you at 877-301-8970. 89, 70. She's also one of those performers who transcended time. We were talking to some of our younger colleagues this morning, and I think she had as profound an impact on their lives as she did on those of us who've been around a while, Marjorie.
Well, you know, she was performing to beat the band, no pun intended there, well into her 70s. Yeah. I mean, I remember when she was seeing her performing and thinking she's dancing in the high heels, she's belting out these songs. And she was belting out these songs and dancing in the high heels long before you could do the lip sync or anything like that. I mean, she was unbelievably powerful. What was, you know, she grew up in a time when it was really, really hard to leave an abusive relationship, as she did
with Ike Turner.
Yeah. And as many of the obituaries point out, when she left this abusive relationship, she was penniless. She had no money. She didn't know if she was ever going to be able to revive her career again. There was a guy that I saw interviewed this morning on MTV who talked about how in 1984, someone came to her and said, hey, Tina Turner's got this new album, this new song that came out. And he says, you know, Tina Turner, I mean, she's washed up from the 60s and 70s. What are you talking about? And they convinced him that they should put her on MTV, where, of course, you could see people performing. And she just went through the roof. I mean, What's Love Got to Do with It? She won all those Grammys. She just had an incredible...
Did you see the documentary, the HBO documentary, Tina?
I saw that, and I saw the play that was done by her life, and it was in Boston.
Yeah,
we interviewed some of the actors in that play, and that was...
You know what's amazing that really stayed with me is that after leaving Turner, an abusive, long-time abusive relationship, again, she was washed up, just as you said a couple of minutes ago. And then finally, when she has her chance and has the comeback, I can't remember from the film, was it in Brazil? Her line was, I want to be seen as, you know, a rock and roller and be able to fill stadiums like the Rolling Stones. And she's performing, I think, in Brazil in front of like
Janeiro,
a quarter of a million people.
180,000 people.
It was such a beautiful
180,000 people. You're the math whiz. Gillette's got 65,000.
55. For an entertainer.
Okay.
It's almost four times.
Yeah.
That, 3.5 times. 877-301-8970. If you want to give us your take on Tina Turner, what did you think of her music? What did she mean in your life kind of thing? She was immense, absolutely immense. And if you're younger and you only know her music and don't know about what she lived through, do check. I think there are two documentaries. I'm not sure. I know there's an HBO one, I think from 2021, I believe, that is spectacular and really captured. And by the way, she's in
it. There's the film.
So it's not one of these unauthorized things. She's in it as a 70-something-year-old woman, maybe an 80-something-year-old woman because she died at 83, commenting on her life. It's just it's a beautiful depiction of a beautiful person's journey.
So she was born in 1939 in Brownsville, Tennessee. Her name was Anna Mae Bullock. And she had a troubled family situation from the first. Her parents did not get along. And they left Anna, as she was called then, and her older sister with relatives when they went to go work in this military installation in Knoxville. And after the war, her mother left her dad. But then Tina... Anna then went to live with her grandmother in Brownsville. So she had a very difficult childhood. Was singing, though, in the Spring Hill Baptist Church down there. And then she ended up going to St. Louis with her sister. And that's where they began going to this Manhattan Club in East St. Louis, where she would hear Ike Turner perform and wanted to sing with him because she knew she had a good voice, never got the chance. Then he finally brings her up to sing. Mm-hmm. Knocks his socks off, and then he makes her the lead singer. But he was always very jealous of her, and I think he realized early on, it reminds me a little bit of Sonny and Cher. I'm not saying that Sonny was at all abuser, but that the big talent was not
obviously
Sonny,
Cher, right.
It was Cher, and the big talent here was not Ike, it was Tina, and as someone wrote in one of these stories about her, she came on like a hurricane, and then she had the Rolling Stones had them perform, open up for them, right? And that was like a big breakthrough.
You know, before we get to your calls and texts, there's a guy I'm dying to, I was just watching during the break, Tina Turner doing Paradise Is Here, and there's a saxophone player who is spectacular, who it turns out is a local guy, he's from Reading. He played saxophone on her tours at a mere 200 and some shows, and he was kind enough to join us for a couple of minutes. Derek Dyer, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for calling in.
My pleasure. I was just listening a little bit here, and thank you for spending so much time on talking about Tina, because without standing, one of the greatest entertainers of all time, and as a person, one of the nicest people you would ever meet.
That's so good to hear. I love that.
So tell us, Derek, how did you guys get together? Oh, I shouldn't say guys. How did you and Tina get together? How did you meet each other?
Okay. I've been... The short story is, mother and father musicians. My father was put out of business by the Beatles in England.
Oh.
We took the family to Bermuda to play in the hotels. I met a band from Worcester. I moved to Worcester, from Bermuda to Worcester. Think about that for a second. Kind of crazy. I ended up playing in a band called American Standard, and then that kind of got picked up by Joe Cocker. I was with Joe for a while. Then that finished. I moved into Boston, played with a lot of local bands, Jonathan Edwards. I played on Rick Ocasek's solo album. So I was very lucky. I was positioned pretty good. And then I was in a band called Fahrenheit that was signed to Warner Brothers. And I was out in L.A. and met Jerry Peterson, who was in a band called Billy and the Beaters. They had a song called At This Moment that was on Family Ties. And it went to number one.
Remember it well.
I was there for like 3 months or something. And I called Jerry to congratulate him. And he just happened to, just in talking, said he'd been called to audition for Tina. Couldn't do it because his wife was expecting a baby. And I said, do you mind if I go after it? And he said, the drummer, Jack Bruno's a very good friend of mine, sent me a bio. Tina auditioned a lot of people, didn't like them. They finally got to me. And I flew out there the day before the Super Bowl, 1987, and the Rose Bowl was hosting the Super Bowl. I had a terrible time getting out there.
You were late, weren't you?
I was late. And she wanted, you know, I was kind of getting messages as I was calling, and she wanted to go home. Anyway, she waited. I walked into this giant rehearsal room with a full band, crew, equipment everywhere, management, and she was standing in the middle of the room with her arms crossed, kind of shooting daggers at me, and the story is that she just looked at me and she started laughing. She said, I told them all to give you a hard time because you were late. And she walked over, gave me a big hug. She said, thank you so much for coming. And then she said, what song do you want to play? And I said, well, I think you get to ask that question. You're Tina Turner. So we played for about an hour, and she was dancing all around me, singing in my ear, and I literally went from my basement to the biggest tour in the world.
Well, and what's it like being on, briefly if you can, Derek, what's it like being on stage with somebody, I mean, one of the most elite performers who's ever walked the planet? What's that like?
You better keep up. Uh-huh. I got called to the office, the dressing room once, because I rephrased something and I got the look, and I walked in and I said, I know what I did. And she said, don't do it again. She started laughing. And she was a leader. She was a woman that was incredibly strong, never carried, an attitude of, everything that she went through. She looked forward. She was just spectacular.
You know, we only have a minute left, Derek, and we're thrilled that you called in. But we know that at one time, and I hope you'll own up to this, you actually had a mullet, which I'm really sorry to hear.
Yeah,
this is true.
You had a mullet, and apparently Tina Turner did not like the mullet. You went on to play with Joe Cocker. And then ultimately, a couple of months later, you had dinner, which I can't even imagine, with Tina Turner, and you had a gift for her. What was the gift, Derek Dyer?
Well, she got me to cut my hair when I joined the band.
Yeah.
Well, like an Elvis look. And then when she realized I had the ponytail while I was working with Joe, she kept on giving me a hard time. So after dinner, I said, I have a gift for you. And she got a little kind of, what the heck is going on here? And I had it cut off, so I had to put it in an envelope, and I handed it to her. And she opened it. She freaked out. She started laughing.
That's
she
great.
Said, just, that's awesome.
Well,
she was just wonderful.
The world lost her, and you did too. And we really appreciate your sharing your experience, Derek. And it's great to have you as a local. Derek Dyer, saxophonist extraordinaire, 230 shows around the world with the great Tina Turner.
And I was at that Rio show.
You were?
And it was crazy. I played that show.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. They had a radio thing, and there was 15,000 people in front of us the day before just for the sound check. Mm. It looked like maybe 600 people. It's that big. Wow. I can't even tell you how big it was. Crazy.
Well, you're a lucky guy, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Derek Dyer, Redding guy, saxophone player, played with some of the greats, including one of the greatest of them all, Tina Turner. Thanks, Derek. Really appreciate
your time. You're doing a wonderful job today.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Let's take some calls.
About the great, late Tina Turner. Let's go to Alan from Truro. Thank you for calling.
Hey there, Alan.
Hi. Long time listener, first time caller.
We love that. Thank you.
Just Tina. Tina, the best concert I ever went to in my whole entire life.
Where'd you go?
1988, Vancouver. Right after she did the Mad Max films, my 80-year-old mother went with us. She was rocking out, and we were rocking out. What did you think, Mom? And she said, she has great legs. It was
She did have great legs.
It's a sad day, but it's a great day because I listened to her on Apple Music all day.
That's what I did all
morning,
too.
You know, every song, yep. Big smile, yeah. Big check. She's a lovely person.
That's a great call, Alan. I'm glad to start. And thanks for your first call. Make another one soon. Appreciate it.
Jeff from Andover points out that Tina Turner was a big-time Buddhist. She talked about it all the time. She wrote a book about it. I think she even did a movie about it. And he pointed out it wasn't mentioned in the Associated Press or New York Times. It was in the Washington Post. But that show, we said that was her Buddhism. Herbie Hancock talked a lot about this, too, is what helped her to survive.
Get through all this,
Yes. And listen to this. In February 2021, I fled my abusive husband with my kids and dog. I showed up at a hotel in the middle of COVID in my bathrobe, asking for a room. I thought of Tina Turner in that moment as I was crying to the man at the front desk. And Tina Turner's story gave me strength. 877-301-8970. We should also say, I mean, she had a tough childhood. She had, she married this German music executive who has still survived, this Erwin Bach guy, and they moved in Sweden. But she taught her only child with Ike Turner died of colon cancer last year. Another son from another relationship committed suicide in 2018. Her sister, Aline, the one that she went to see Ike Turner with, has been dead for years. But she did raise the two children of Ike Turner, Ike Jr. and Michael. Mm. So she had a very complicated family life as well. Rich from Derry, thank you for calling.
Hey, Rich.
A lot of people don't know that just as she was trying to get things going, she sang for Frank Zappa in the Mothers of Invention.
She did?
She was on the album called Overnight Sensation, and she sang Dynamo Hum. She was a female vocalist on Dynamo Hum.
Wow. How do you know that? Just being a fan, or what's your deal, Rich?
Being a Frank Zappa fan. She's one of the lines is there, Dynamo Hum, where's this dynamo coming from? It's been 3 hours, it ain't gonna crumb. Dynamo.
That's one of the finest Tina Turner imitations I've ever heard. Thank you
very good
for the call. We had Weasel on the show, but we never had Frank on the show.
Yes, we did not. Let's play a little bit of sound from Tina Turner. This is when she's playing with Mick Jagger at the Live Aid concert in 1985. The song, It's Only Rock and Roll. And what's really great is when you see them both dancing together, and a lot of people think that she gave him a lot of his dance moves, Jim. Here's one from another texter that points out Tina Turner, not much mention yet of her incredible performance in the Rock Queen Tommy as the Acid Queen with the most powerful singing voice. And then here's from Jeannie. He says, I saw Tina in concert in 1987 at the New York State Fair and 2008 in Chicago. The two concerts were 21 years apart, but her energy level was the same, as well as her high heels.
Yeah, she looked pretty good on that stage, I should say.
Margaret in Chestnut Hill, thanks for calling.
Hello, Margaret.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I
I've been doing for 40 years a show on PBS called Body Electric. It's a fitness show.
Oh.
And, yeah, and because it is on PBS, we could use any music that's ASCAP or BMI. So unlike other shows, I was able to use, you know, everything. And when Tina Turner, when we used her music, it just gave us, like, a boost to the soul, you know? It was the best.
Well, I mean, it is about the highest energy music, like, ever, in addition to being wonderful. Yeah. I mean, it is, right, Margaret?
The best, yeah. I mean, there's some music that, you know, you can tap your foot to, but her music just electrifies. It electrifies the air, you know?
Like that, you electrifies know. The air. Beautifully said. Margaret, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. What are you saying? I'm sorry.
Everybody, when you hear Proud Mary, I mean, you're just waiting for the rhythm to change so you can bop around the kitchen dancing to Proud Mary. I mean, that was an unbelievable song. Our earlier guest today, Sarah Bernhardt, does a whole thing about Proud Mary on her show, doing the imitation from the
she
really
does it,
slow
right?
beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, to the really fast. And I got to go look this up, but I didn't realize that she played the Beatles' Help in a much slower tempo than the Beatles did it too. So she gives a whole different twist to that. By the way, we just played some music of her with Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger tweeted after news of her death, "I'm so saddened by the passing of my wonderful friend Tina Turner. She was truly an enormously talented performer and singer, inspiring, warm, funny, and generous. She helped me so much when I was young, and I will never forget her."
What's that again?
All sorts of people tweeted about her.
Well, it's also nice to hear from Dirk Dyer, who played with her, to hear her say, "I always get nervous when you have huge admiration for a big public figure and you either meet the figure or you meet somebody who knew them well, and you're always nervous they're going to say they're not what they're cracked up to be as a person." And he went out of his way to say, "Even a better person than a performer," which is actually pretty beautiful.
No, we have not heard that about. I think the jury is in, and everyone seemed to say she was an absolutely lovely person. Had a not an easy life, but she was really a sensation. Anyway, we are done for today. We're going to go out with Tina Turner, of course. Saying "What's Love Got to Do With It," one of her great hits in the 80s. I want to thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Tomorrow, we are live at the Boston Public Library. Governor Maura Healey will be with us for Ask the Governor from 1 to 2. She's going to take our questions and yours. We'll also be joined by media maven Sue O'Connell, who was just Coyote Woman attacked with her dog. Everybody's fine, by a coyote over near her house in Roxbury. Tech guru Andy Notko will be with us as well. TikTok sensation Karen Tran to teach us how to make cute felted animals and maybe teach Jim how to chill out a bit. Tall order. And plus a live music Friday performance by Workman Song ahead of Boston Calling this weekend. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aiden Conley, Nicole Garcia, Hannah Loss, our engineer John the Claw Parker, our executive producer is Jenny Bologna. I'm Marjorie Egan. He's Jim Browdy. Thanks for tuning in today. Hope you can join us tomorrow. And meanwhile, have a great afternoon.